Okay. Is it restarted?
Yes,
Okay.
it started. Yep.
All right. Welcome to the Jefferson County Public Hospital District Number 2 Board of Commissioners meeting on Wednesday, April 28, 2021. This meeting will consist of two main parts, board education from 2 until 3:15, when we will take a 15-minute recess and reconvene at 3:30 for our business session. This virtual meeting is being held under Governor Inslee's COVID-19 Notice of Proclamation 2028, and there will be no live public comment. Our community members are welcome to comment on any item or concern via a letter addressed to the commissioners at 834 Sheridan Street, Port Townsend, 98368, or via email to commissioners@jeffersonhealthcare.org. This session is being officially audio recorded and times shown on the agenda are estimate only. I now call for a move to approve today's agenda with the following changes. In lieu of our stated discussion on Robert's Rules of Order and Code of Conduct, we want to present to you a video by Karma Bass on health equity, a timely topic and one important to our organization. The video runs an hour, and we have available to us an hour and 15 minutes with our two sessions combined. Our plan is for the video to be followed with a brief update from Commissioner Kayskoff, our board representative on the Jefferson Healthcare Health Equity Task Force. Additionally, Commissioner Kauf has asked for a moment of silence to begin our business session at 3:30. He will explain at the appropriate time. Is there a motion to accept the agenda as amended?
So moved.
Is there a second? It's been moved and seconded. Is there discussion? All in favor say aye.
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 Chair votes aye. Thank you. So we will launch the presentation now. Are we ready, Alyssa?
Yes.
Oh, okay, thank you.
Can you everyone see my screen?
Yes, thank you.
Yes. Do we have sound on that?
Can you not hear it?
No.
Oh. One second. Can you hear it now?
I can hear you.
No.
No.
My apologies. I'm going to have to probably call IT really quick to figure this out.
Okay. Maybe we could kind of reverse and maybe Case could tell us what is new about our. Where did Case go? Case?
Yes.
We are having trouble getting the sound, the audio portion
right.
of our presentation. Do you want to give us an update now before and then we could watch it afterwards?
Sure. I could do that. Let me start off by saying I was not expecting to give an update, so this is going to be strictly from my limited memory bank. I believe I've updated the board occasionally as we have gone along with some of the activities that the staff is involved in. Most recently, this last month, we participated in a session with our cohort members in our Institute for Healthcare Improvement cohort, which includes entities from all over the country who are all in the same 18-month cohort of developing strategies and very specific plans for how to address health equity, racism, and not only racism in our own institutions, but how to be anti-racist in our communities. And we're at the point where we're starting to hear from this cohort, I might add, I believe it started roughly in September. And so we're not even halfway through this 18-month program. We've received a lot of background information in order to get us to understand what racism is, the problems of health equity and how that has played out in our country over the last many decades, actually. Then we've been given some framework, some guidelines as to how to develop benchmarks, strategies, and benchmarks for evaluating our strategies as they are implemented. And so this last, the last meeting with our cohort, we actually heard some, they had several presenters, several groups, one in particular presenting a dashboard that they had developed for monitoring their progress towards their own particular goals in their strategy for addressing racism in their institution and in their community. And it was really a remarkable dashboard. I mean, I was just sort of blown away. And sure enough, within, couldn't be more than 2 weeks, Adam in IT here at Jefferson Healthcare had implemented the same approach and plugged in the, began to plug in the data that addressed some of our strategies in terms of really measure, being able to measure very specifically the relative health equity of different different peoples coming to our institution for care. And so I won't begin to describe that, but I would strongly recommend that perhaps at our next meeting, we have Dunya and Adam and some of the others who are involved in this. Let me say in the last health equity meeting, we had basically 10 of us who devoted an hour to getting an update from Dunya and all of the different people working in our own program to address health equity. And I was just so impressed with the dedication, everyone who was there, people taking time out of their very busy schedules. You know, here we are dealing with all of the ramifications of the pandemic in our community, and at the same time making a serious commitment to addressing health equity and racism. I can't begin to tell you some of the specifics, in particular because some of it may not be ready quite yet for prime time. And so as tempted as I was to take some screenshots and send them to the commissioners in preparation for this meeting, I resisted because I really don't want to steal the thunder. I don't want to unveil something that's not ready for all of us to see. But it's just really really been a very eye-opening and heartwarming experience to see the dedication that we have going into this program.
Is there one aha moment that you've had that you could share with us about something that was, you said there were some pretty mind-blowing things?
Well, I'm not sure that I ever understood how pervasive racism is in our society and in all of the systems in our community. And I'm, you know, it's for those of us who have not, for those of us who are privileged and who have benefited tremendously from the system that's been in place for, well, let's just admit it, hundreds of years, it's just very, very difficult to put ourselves in the shoes of those who are not privileged and who continue to face racism every day in different ways. And since I wasn't prepared, what I could do, I could take a minute and see if I have, there are a couple of quotes that that really struck me. Well, here we go. Here's one that actually, this one is from the Culture of Health, and I believe I sent this out to the board. I sent out a link, and this was sent to us by, I can't remember who on the staff found this and sent it around. So this is from the from the National Academy of Medicine, which also has really begun to tackle this problem in a very major way. And one of the quotes that struck me from that was, quote, "Discrimination appears to exert its greatest effects not because of exposure to a single life traumatic incident, but because people must mentally and physically contend with or be prepared to contend with seemingly minor insults and assaults on a near continual basis. The implications appear to be greatest for stress-related conditions such as those tied to hypertension, mental health outcomes, substance abuse behaviors, and birth-related outcomes." So I'm just realizing that it's a lifelong challenge for me, and I suspect for many others, to really begin to understand, comprehend, what so many people are living with around in this country, well, and around the world.
Any other comments? Well, it's certainly it's about time, and it's so great that this is finally being acknowledged and addressed. How are we doing with the video, Alyssa?
I think we got it figured out.
Okay, great. Let's roll.
All right.
And now I'd like. Good afternoon and welcome to today's webinar, What's in Your Health Equity Playbook? Roles and Responsibilities for Hospital Boards.
Can everyone hear that?
Before the presentation begins, I'd like to share a few housekeeping notes.
I can.
Yes.
Again, everyone participating has been set to listen only mode. If you have any questions, please use the chat function in the lower right-hand corner of your screen. You can also use the hand icon to raise your hand. We'll do our best to answer all questions at the end of the session. We are recording today's webinar, and a copy will be made available for future viewing. Today's session provides one credit hour towards the WSHA Healthcare Governance Certification or Recertification. Information on how to log your credit hour will be provided at the end of today's webinar. And now I'd like to introduce our speakers for today's session. Over the past 25 years, Karma Bass has worked with healthcare leaders across the United States on governance, strategic planning, philanthropy, policy, and board effectiveness. Prior to launching her consulting career, she served as president and CEO of Alliance Healthcare Foundation in San Diego, where she reported to an independent 11-member not-for-profit board. Notably, Karma spent 10 years at the Governance Institute, where she led both the Member Services and Research and Publications divisions. Dr. Maria Hernandez is President and Chief Operating Officer of Impact for Health, a consulting firm focused on healthcare innovations, strategy, and community engagement to reduce healthcare disparities. She's led the research for the Inclusion Scorecard for Population Health and the Inclusive Leader 360, each of which is designed to advance health equity and create a culture of inclusion that meets the needs of diverse patient populations. Dr. Hernandez also serves as Secretary of the Board of Trustees for Alameda Health System, with a membership on the Human Resource and Quality and Professional Services Committees. Without further ado, I'll turn things over to Karma and Maria.
Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you so much, Ryan. It's really a pleasure to be here with all of you today. I'm sorry that we can't be gathering in person, but this is the world we're living in these days, and I do hope that this will be useful to you and good information for you to gather today. As you know, the COVID crisis has really exposed a number of systematic problems in the healthcare industry that we are going to have to deal with as healthcare leaders. One of the most troubling of these is how much it has highlighted the healthcare inequities that still exist and are so pervasive within our healthcare system and also within our society. So what Dr. Hernandez and I have prepared for you here today are some objectives. Our goal is to give you some foundational information that we hope will kind of lay a groundwork for further conversation and further study. We want to give you some specific ideas because that's always, you know, what we believe you're here for is what can we actually do. So we're going to give you some of those as well. However, I hope it's really apparent that we're not trying to do a fully fleshed out work plan here, and this is definitely not a comprehensive treatment. So there are lots of, as you know, good resources on these topics, and we hope that you'll use this as the launching pad for further inquiry and discussion with your colleagues on the board about these topics. And if you need more information, Dr. Hernandez is a wealth of information about health inequities, so please feel free to reach out to her. And of course, if I can be help in any way, please don't hesitate to reach out to us as well, to me as well. So where does it start? Some may wonder, where do we even begin to address these incredibly complex issues? The suggestion that I would give you is start where you are. Every board and every individual is going to be at a different place on the spectrum of understanding these issues and having a sense of how to address them. One thing I'd like to suggest is that for my fellow white people out there, it probably starts with a bit of introspection as well. Healthcare inequities are driven by the underlying systemic racism that exists in our society. And we as white people need to understand more than we have, I believe, historically. So this conversation is going to be a conversation about leadership in the healthcare industry and caring for communities and patients. But it's also probably going to be a personal conversation at some point. And I think we just need to be prepared for that. It's not a comfortable conversation, but I would say to you, if the conversation is overly comfortable, then you're probably not really getting at it, because these are deep conversations. It's a difficult issue. And if it were easy to address, if there were silver bullets out there, hopefully we would have done something more about it when these issues first surfaced in the research 30 years ago. So on your screen now is just a couple of things that clients that I'm working with are considering doing and they're working on. One client is redoing their strategic plan, and the board has been pushing for health equity to not only be one of the enabling pillars, which it has been and is, and health equity is one of the pillars of the values of the organization, but they are also interested in understanding what it would look like if health equity were one of the core objectives of the plan. So that's something they're considering. I've got a couple of clients around the country that are forming new board committees or a subcommittee on this topic. Social justice, health equity are some of the titles that they're considering. And if you're interested in seeing samples of what those board committee charters look like, you know, by all means, reach out to me or reach out to Ashley at WSHA. And then, you know, definitely talking about community health dashboards, that's something that Dr. Hernandez will give you more information about in a moment. And her organization does some really good work around the metrics for that type of thing. And then lastly, just starting to ask the questions, that quality data that's being presented to you, how does this look when it's stratified by race or ethnicity or other demographics that might include other types of diversity that we know our communities possess? So before I go any further, I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Hernandez and have her lead you through some foundational information about this topic. Dr. Hernandez?
Yeah, thank you so much, Karma. And thank you so much for the Washington State Hospital Association inviting us today to be with you. I do want to level set on a few terms that get used quite a bit and are important to make sure we're all kind of on the same page. You know, we have a very strong cultural and legal framework in our country that argues for equal treatment as being fair. Unfortunately, this doesn't consistently produce equal outcomes in a number of settings like education and healthcare. So treating everyone the same does not produce equal outcomes. I relate to that little tiny person unable to reach that apple at 5'2". If you give me the same kind of stepping board as others, I'd never get anywhere. And so think of this as an analogy for the way in which that social gradient, the social class and economic disparities really impact lives. And you'll notice that in essence, you know, you can't treat everyone the same. And so we define health equity in a very specific way. It's the absence of systematic disparities that, if we could go back just one more time, I just want to make sure we get that. Sorry about that, Karma. Yeah, we define it as the absence of systematic disparities in health and its determinants between groups of people at different levels of social advantage. To attain health equity means to close that gap in health between populations that have different levels of wealth, power, and/or social prestige or status. Next slide. The other two terms that we kind of get, you know, bogged down in are health disparities and health inequities. And there really are different applications of those terms in the clinical environment. The best example that I want to give is to look at different rates of cancer, for example, between, say, men and women. So 1% of all breast cancers occur in men, primarily because of the different levels of estrogen in men and women. The disparity rates between men and women is understood to be biological, right? But if you look at the mortality rate for breast cancer among women, it's disproportionately high among African American women. Even if we control for income, education, health insurance status, it's pretty sad, but the mortality rate for Black women in this country diagnosed with breast cancer is 42% higher than that of white women. So this is a health outcome inequity. And what's the basis of the inequity? Many things. It can be late stage diagnosis. It can be the types of treatment offered to women. It can be their access to specialists that are going to look at specifically their needs. So the key factor here is that the root cause of this inequity is found to be unjust. it's attributable to some social factor, some other condition, and it's exposures to toxins or poverty or living in a food desert or poor quality of air and so on. So those are the differences between those two terms. I know they get used interchangeably, but I wanted to be mindful of just being a little bit more precise. If we go to the next slide, we also tend to talk about racism and bias as if it's just what's experienced between two people of different backgrounds or even within the same cultural group. Racism is not just a subject that is to be studied among whites. There is colorism in my community of Latinos. There's colorism in African-American communities. So the fact is that unconscious bias is just one element of bias. We all have it. It's a nature of the human condition, if you will. But this graph, I hope, illustrates to you that we need to think about bias in a multi-layered manner. It's not just enough to think about that interaction with a patient or the interaction with others on the team that are of diverse backgrounds. We need to look at the systemic factors that are going on at the institution, in the community, and certainly in the society at large, or the systemic factors. So when we think about some of those health inequities and the root causes, it can be about those institutional or community-wide biases that show up in our assumptions. For example, we now are seeing a number of organizations across the country use telehealth as the new way to see a physician. And for anyone on this call, it's a great convenience. Chances are you're very comfortable with using telehealth. But imagine someone who's not comfortable with the new Zoom environment that we're in, or WebEx environment. That's one factor. Another is, you know, maybe they don't have the ability to log on during normal business hours, 9 to 5, that their job may be very different. So again, these are policies that we create thinking, well, this is a great way to serve the population that we want to address. But it creates some unintended consequences of structural or systemic bias in who can actually access those services. So as Karma said a moment ago, we are now living in a moment where we're really seeing the impact of systemic bias and inequities. If we go to the next slide, you'll see just one example for a metro area in Seattle. And again, this is just a highlight of one location. You can see that the cases per 100,000 residents is extremely high among Latinos, among Blacks, and among Native Hawaiian and Pacific Islander. If you look at the percent of the population that is Latino, again, percent of population that is Black, again, there's real disparities there. And we are seeing this across the nation. And this really has elevated the importance of this conversation. So those are just a few of the terms that I want to make sure we're kind of level setting around and having a really concrete example about how inequities can show up specifically right now in COVID-19. Karma, back to you.
Great, thank you. So thank you. The grounding is so helpful, I think, in ensuring we're having a conversation, we're talking about the same things. As those of you that might have heard me talk before, you know, I always try to take things back to the board's responsibilities. And of course, this webinar today is specifically targeted for a board member audience. So for those of you that on the webinar that are with administration or clinicians, you know, thank you for joining us. And I hope this is helpful. But please know that our intended audience is board members. And so I want to start off by just sharing with you one way to categorize board responsibilities. Now, different lists will show this worded differently or put in different buckets, but hopefully you can agree that this is kind of a high level 30,000 foot view of what the board's responsibilities should be. And the question is, well, where do issues of health equity fall into board responsibilities? And I think what I would suggest to you is that because of the multifaceted nature of this issue, as Dr. Hernandez just showed on the earlier slide, different levels and layers of this, my opinion is that this weaves through all of the board responsibilities. And so as you know one of the most important roles that a board plays is asking good questions. And so these are some questions around each of the board areas of responsibility that you might ask. And please know that I'm not suggesting by putting these four as questions that every single one of them should be yes, or that you should take on every single one at a time. I'm a big believer in walking before you can run and beginning where you are, as I mentioned earlier. But as you think about what's the board job in all of this, you know, how do we, how is it involved in our strategic plan? What do our quality metrics look like stratified? And Dr. Hernandez is going to give us some more information about that in a minute. The third bullet, I think, is particularly important because, you know, how we allocate our resources is an indication of our value set. And we need to make it very clear that our values include actively working toward a more just society, which is part of what actively working toward greater health equity for all our communities is. And so I think one of the questions to ask, and you know, don't assume that because you've never heard about it, that it isn't happening. That's one thing I would just caution you. I do see boards make that mistake at times if it hasn't been in your board packet, or if your CEO or one of his team members, her team members, haven't presented on health equity. You may think, well, gosh, we're not doing anything. I bet there's a great deal that's going on in the organization. And so sometimes these questions, what they can prompt is almost a conversation at the board level that really is more educational and informational than action oriented to begin with. And I think that's perfectly appropriate. So I would just encourage you to consider asking these questions and consider that the questions can be asked in different committees that you're having and by different members of the board. I think that there's no silver bullet, and so we're going to have to continue to work on this. This is going to be, if we truly take this on, this is going to change the way that we work. It's going to change the way that we see ourselves, that we see our role, and in fact, I would put forward that I think it should. There's not a single bullet, silver bullet, that's going to solve this, and, you know, I think as board members, we have to stay in conversation with our colleagues, in conversation with the management team and our physician and clinical leaders to figure out what the right way to navigate is. I think one thing I'd like to, you know, emphasize is that as you're asking these questions, as you're learning more about what the organization is doing, what the organization could be doing, it's really important as board members to be very clear on the hat that you're wearing. And with the questions you ask, perhaps frame them in a context of, I'm very interested in understanding what management's plans are for this topic. I think that's absolutely critical that board members in this continue to respect the distinction between their role and the role of management. And it's a tricky thing to do as a board member, but we have to. Our job is to set the policy, to set the guardrails, to ask for plans, to insist on reporting on plans if the plans aren't being met, ask for an explanation as to why things are not happening. But it's very important to board members that you have to resist the temptation to dive down into the details other than asking questions that help illustrate things for your information. As you might imagine, the lack of clarity between the role of the board and the role of management is the number one issue that has that I'm helping clients with in my career and number one issue that I tend to see. So that you always coming back to roles, I think you can't go wrong with that. And I would just encourage you to consider that. So along those lines of, you know, imagining what your role is as a board member and remembering, as we talk about this issue, this is not an invitation for an individual board member to go on a personal crusade about this. You, as a board member, you have the challenge and the opportunity that the way that things happen is that you work through and with your colleagues on the board. So, you know, this is something that there should be conversation at the board level. I would be willing to bet good money that most, if not all of you, are having these conversations at the board level. But if you aren't yet at a place where the board as a whole, or at least the majority of the board members, can support a common direction on some of these things, the things that fall into the board's area of purview, then I would suggest more conversation is still needed. So continue to ask these questions and continue to work with and through your chief executive officer on this issue. I've not seen a board yet that is highly effective and a really top performing board that has a crummy relationship with its CEO. So with all these questions, they're not going to always be comfortable conversations, and it's going to take different people different amounts of time to kind of wrap their mind around things. And of course, you know, people are going to have different points of view, but it's important that as board members, the way that you approach the issues, both with your colleagues and with your chief executive, is from a lens of partnership. And, you know, as I said, there's never been, if you've got an antagonistic relationship with your chief executive or if one of your colleagues on the board does, that's going to get in the way of true change happening. And I believe that's what we're really looking for in all of this. And, you know, just in case you don't already live this every day, you know, especially those of you that serve on the district boards and publicly elected boards, you know that your life is in a fishbowl. And so what I wanted to suggest to you is that if for some reason you've got colleagues who are not entirely on the fence as to whether this is something the organization needs to take on, the thing that they should understand and that you can convey is that the expectations for healthcare organizations is changing. And so this is one of those areas, kind of like, you know, quality improvement maybe 10 or 15 or 20 years ago, where if you're not continuing to enhance, improve, get better at issues around health equity, you're likely to be falling behind. And I can imagine in the future that there are going to be a lot of constituencies, including some of the ones here, that are going to be very interested to know what your organization is proactively doing to address these issues. I think it's very, you know, we have to realize that if we are not actively working to overcome the issues of health equity, we're perpetuating a system that's deeply unfair. So we need to be constantly thinking about not only doing the right thing, but what are we actively doing to overcome these things, and what do our constituencies expect of us? Because I would say going forward, it's going to be something that's going to shift and change. So I am going to turn it back over now to Dr. Hernandez, and I'll let you take it from here.
Thanks so much, Karma. And what I wanted to do is feature just one example early on before we dive into what's in the health equity playbook. I just want to feature one example of what can happen when the CEO, the board, and the community align on identifying the best way to care for the most vulnerable populations. So there's a lot of literature out there on this particular entity's activities, but ProMedica Health is a nonprofit based out of Northwest Michigan. About 5 years ago, they really began to think about how to look at those social determinants of health that are often very impactful in the care that can be given to a patient. And so at that time, they began an initiative called Come to the Table, because they found so many of their patients, especially in the high-risk pool, were food insecure. That means that they don't know where their next nutritious meal is coming from. So just imagine how many more people today are facing that kind of incredible strain in their families, where they just don't know if they're going to be able to put food on the table. And imagine a family member that needs to go to the hospital, not for COVID-19. Maybe it's something that they've been dealing with for a long time, a chronic condition. they began to just say, how can anyone actually focus on their care if they are food insecure? So it's a really good case study of how one system built their health equity playbook around one social determinant of health, food insecurity. And they did everything you can imagine. They integrated some questions about food insecurity into the electronic health record. So everyone was being asked a couple of questions about their next meal and how they felt about where they were going to, whether they were going to have a nutritious meal. They also then began to create a care package as part of the first course of treatment, if you will, after a visit. So if someone did qualify for being food insecure, they actually didn't leave that clinic or that site without having something that they could take home. And they also had a referral system so that the community partners that they had formed would be able to do some outreach with that particular person. And they began to basically define that hunger is a basic health need, and you can't treat someone for their conditions unless that need is met first. So on the next slide, what you'll see is kind of the arc of their journey. You'll notice that they started off by, you know, asking, what is our mission? And given our mission, how do we approach the different needs of the communities that we're trying to serve? And they had some really important questions internally about what's the role of a hospital in addressing those needs, given the kind of impact that something like food insecurity might create. So the term food desert is something that exists out in public health. And they began to look at the connection between zip codes where those food deserts existed and obesity rates and diabetes and so on. And you can see their journey really led to an incredibly different way of thinking about how they were going to serve the community of patients that they saw. So I just want to bring that up early, that there are really good examples of everything that Karma just described, a focused energy around how to address inequities, an attempt to look at what is the big picture, our partnerships with the community, our capacity to do the right thing and align those resources, as she said. And so they are a good example, and I've got references of articles if you should need to help any help finding those. But let's now begin with what goes into a health equity playbook. So I want to start with this graph and quickly say we're going to stay at a high level, but it's impossible to address health equity effectively unless you pay attention to these four really significant buckets of activity. And I'll go through each one of these. I will share with you that our firm created an online platform to help you go through these and assess where you are. And we give that out for free. If you need technical support, of course, we can come in and support you with that. But I do want to say there is a lot of information out there about what works to advance health equity. The challenge is that very few hospitals today have a chief health equity officer. So it's not like someone is already, you know, charged to do this. And all of these activities are in disparate parts of the organization. There are a lot of silos in healthcare, as far as I can tell. And so it's hard for people to talk about health equity across the different service areas, across the different ways in which everybody needs to coordinate that care. So let's start first with the one at the top. And if you go to the next slide, let's talk about promoting a culture of inclusion. So in order to do that, whenever I start working with a hospital, I actually look first on their webpage, and I look, does their mission statement, does the value statement have anything about equity, about the concern for vulnerable populations? Typically, there's a lot of focus on quality of care, but the link between quality and equity isn't necessarily drawn out. Another thing to look for is whether or not there's cultural competency training, or if there are programs around a specific type of service for a population. So I'm familiar with a hospital in Los Angeles that had a large number of Latinos. Diabetes was really prevalent there. and they had a diabetes prevention program. But this diabetes prevention program was unlike anything you would imagine. They didn't just say exercise, they suggested salsa. They didn't just say good food or healthy food. They showed the participants how to kind of reframe some of our traditional dishes of Latin America and do them in a way that might be more healthy. So that's a really good example of cultural competency. And again, we've emphasized this a few times, we'll say it again, are there resources evident that are moving the needle forward on creating that culture? So having a chief equity officer, having program staff that are very dedicated to those unique, vulnerable populations and the needs they have is all part of creating this culture of inclusion, right? The next bucket, let's go to the next slide, is about the data. So I think everyone on the call knows if it's not being measured, it's not being managed. And that could not be more true, Peter Drucker's famous line, in healthcare. And so there's enormous efforts now to make sure that hospitals are collecting real and SOGI data, that stands for race, ethnicity, and language preference, and sexual orientation and gender identity. There are ways to collect that properly, and your EHR can help with that, but there is training required to do that in a way that allows the person to feel safe and to feel like it's an important question in their care and treatment. And then once that data is collected, again, now we start to look at clinical performance outcome data by REAL and SOGI, or patient experience by REAL and SOGI. We have to set goals. Once we know if there are disparities, if there are inequities, we need to make sure we're setting goals around improving those through targeted outreach efforts or new programs to serve that population. But you can't begin unless you measure what's happening now. And there is a lot of evidence that people collect the data, but they're not necessarily looking at it for the specific kind of information that I've just described. And some of you may be wondering, wow, that seems to be kind of has some liability to it. There's some risks involved. There are. But one of my clients has actually published a medical error incident that occurred that was based on bias. And it was turned into a learning opportunity for the organization and for the communities around us here in the Bay Area. And I would just offer that the data is out there that suggests these inequities exist. You may not want to peek and take a look at what's happening specifically in your population, but I think that's part of the challenge and part of the problem. We have to have the courage to ask these questions, as Karma said early on. So let's go to the next one. And this is about establishing accountability for quality of care and health equity. So if you're looking at quality metrics and you're not slicing the data by REAL and SOGI, you're assuming that everyone is experiencing your system in the same way. And chances are that's not happening. Even with the best of intentions, there's going to be issues because people are different and there are unique needs. So once you begin to look for this information, it's about leveraging different policies and protocols and practices that promote health equity and linking standards with senior leadership performance metrics. That's probably the hardest thing to do, and it's a conversation that's really thorny, but it's somewhere. It has to start, and the buck has to stop somewhere. People need to be held accountable for looking at this data and doing the best they can to try and navigate to some solutions, whether it's internal or external, to support those diverse patient populations. I also believe that there has to be a metric or a dashboard summary of all of these. As a board member, it's a real struggle sometimes. We look at a lot of different pieces of information. We have three or four different dashboards that we look at every time we meet, and that board packet can get to be the 350 pages, right? But if it's summarized in a manner in which you become accustomed to looking at trend lines and quarterly asking, are we actually achieving what we set out to achieve in terms of any number of things. The number of patients who are actually getting preventative care and the diversity of those, does that match our community? When you have that kind of data readily available, your job as a board member is indeed much easier, and it fulfills, I believe, an important requirement. Let's go to the next. And the last one is about engaging those community stakeholders to reduce the inequities that exist in the in your community. Kaiser Permanente Family Foundation and also the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation have some wonderful kits to help assess where your community stands on some of these. And these are really hard issues to look at, but I want to call out how important it is to partner with the right entities, whether it's a faith-based organization, a community group, your public health department, to actually understand what's happening in the communities that you serve. It is impossible to produce the population health strategy that solves some of these concerns about high-risk populations without understanding where people live and work. And so when there's food deserts, when there's high unemployment or really poor housing stock, something that I've actually studied quite a bit in terms of its impact on asthma with pediatric patients, you've really run the risk of working very hard to work with a person in your emergency department or in your clinics, and you're sending them right back into the very source of the problem. So more and more hospitals are looking at what kind of partnerships can be forged in order to address those. If we go to this next graph, it shows kind of a high-level summary of what are some of those variables that are upstream, midstream, and downstream. And it would give you some guidance, if you will, on where to leverage some of your influence as a member of the community. Hospitals are very large at times. They have a lot of power. They have a lot of say in how things might happen in a specific neighborhood. So you may be able to point out where are these concerns in those upstream social determinants of health. But in the middle is where access to care, of course, is one that is truly part of our work and needed to be able to address the disparities. And the actions that we take further downstream, providing the kind of programming or support for addressing some of these concerns, is again very much important for the board to discuss and understand this sort of lay of the land of where in your community you may most want to leverage your resources and your connections and your relationships with the right community partners. So I'm going to stop there and turn it back over to Karma.
Great. Thank you so much. Such good information. I love this chart, by the way. I think I got the reference from you because I want to use this. So we wanted to switch gears and talk about kind of what, so this is good information. What can the board do, or where might you start with some of this? And these were, this is a brainstormed list that Dr. Hernandez and I have discussed. First and foremost, as we've talked about, it starts with asking good questions. And, you know, again, please be sure that as you ask the questions, you're truly listening for the answer and using it as a learning opportunity for yourself. It's not the type of question, I think I see boards sometimes ask questions where they, you know, it's a question, but it's really disguised, it's a direction that's being disguised as a question, kind of like when I am talking to my teenagers and I say, you're going to clean your room, aren't you? And that's not really a question. I'm sort of telling them what I want them to do, but I'm being polite and putting it in a question. This is not the kind of questions we're talking about that boards should engage in. What I'm looking for, what I'm suggesting are very authentic questions and taking time to listen. The diversity and the issue of tokenism is something that we really have not even begun to scratch the surface as a set of organizations, as healthcare governance. This is really something that we fall down in. And I think I would suggest to you that, unfortunately, oftentimes, because this seems like perhaps such a hard nut to crack, people tend to take a little bit of a check the box mentality. And, you know, we've gotten an additional person of color on our board, so we're good. Or, well, we can't address that because we're an elected board. Well, you've got committees, many of you, and those committees include members of the community. How diverse are those committees? And if you are a board that's self-perpetuating, you identify your own members and you've gotten a person or two of color, I would suggest to you that it's not enough. There was a study that Harvard Business Review published in 2006, and it's related to gender diversity on boards, and it's about corporate boards, but I think it's still a really interesting article. It's a quick read if you're curious. But basically, they did research in 2005, and they looked at corporate boards across the United States, and they looked where boards had one or more women on them and looked at the difference. And what they determined is that it takes about three women on the typical sized board, which I believe is like 12 to 15 members, before the actual dynamics in the boardroom changed. And they identified some very specific positive ways in which the dynamics of the boardroom shift when you've got enough gender diversity in this case to really be meaningful. And prior to that number, prior to a critical mass of diverse people around the table, the people that are at the table are going to feel like tokens, and they're going to feel not necessarily going to feel included. One of the examples that's given in the article is, one of the women said that she made a point that the board ended up acting on, and the chair at the end of the meeting thanked the other woman at the table, because there were only two, for bringing up such a good point. And nobody corrected him that it wasn't the one woman, it was the other. So I think we need to just be aware. The other thing we need to do is look at our own practices as a board, and are we being inclusive when we invite Black, Indigenous, people of color to the table? Because sometimes our own practices get in the way of people being fully engaged. I was talking to Health Systems CEO this morning. We were talking about an African-American board member that they've brought on who hasn't been able to participate as much as they would like, and as much as some of the other board members do. And I was reminding him that inclusion is an ongoing process. And what we need to do is we need to talk to our board members and make sure that the way that we, the time that we hold our board meetings, the length of the board meetings, the expectation around serving on committees, all of those things could be potentially barriers to the kind of diversity that you want to have sitting at the table. It's important that we continue our education on issues of race and health equity. Again, as white people, our education on racism has been woefully incompetent. Growing up in this society, I myself have really undertaken trying to learn more. And there's so many good books out there right now. There's so many good podcasts. We need to understand more, and we need to listen to the people around us who come from the Black, Indigenous, or the peoples of color communities, so that we can truly hear and be led by their perspectives and what they see as their needs and priorities. Being patiently impatient is a true skill, and I've seen some board leaders display this just so well. And basically what it means is you have an obligation to continue to ask for or bring up issues that you feel are important that the organization needs to focus on, but you have an obligation also to do it in a way that doesn't drive off your colleagues and the management team, and is sensitive to the other things going on or the other dynamics that might be at play. And so what this means is, if you're asking about something to be done, be sure you listen to the answer. I was observing a board meeting a couple weeks ago where the board members were not happy because a document hadn't gone to a committee before it came to the full board for action, which is the typical process. And a board member said, why didn't this go to the committee? That's not our process. I'm feeling not comfortable about perhaps approving this today. And, the answer was, well, we wanted to take action on it quickly. It's related to, you know, what's going on with COVID. We didn't have a meeting before. We had the committee meeting was after the board meeting, and we felt like we needed to get this started before the second half of the year, so, you know, before July 1. And yet the board member was still not happy with that answer. So I think, you know, again, you have the right to be unhappy with things, but you also have an obligation to put yourself in the other person's spot and recognize these things are going to take time, but continue to ask questions and ask for follow-up. The humility and the staying in your lane is both, if you are a white board member, it's important to practice humility. We don't fully understand this. This is not our full experience. We need to stay in our lane as white people and not speak for people of color, not try to, you know, not try to overtake the issues, let them be the leaders on the issues where they care to. And we also, as board members, need to practice humility and stay in our lane. There are many, many things going on in your organizations. These are completely, it's an overused word, but completely unprecedented time. And so we have to be sure that we are being mindful of the very real activities that are going on that we may not be fully aware of. And then just get comfortable with being uncomfortable. One of the CEOs that I worked with at one point in time, and this was her quote to her board, "I think it's time for us to get comfortable with being uncomfortable. And if you're doing this work truly and well, I believe you will probably have some uncomfortable conversations." So, you know, again, in the interest of trying to help give you some ways to follow up with this, this set of questions are ones that if you're just beginning your journey as a board on topics of health equity, these might be some early questions that you could ask and consider thinking about. Dr. Hernandez, I'll turn it over to you to finish this slide and take sure. to the next.
Sure. I think that these are what we would call the fundamental questions to draw from. Each one of these could take you separate meetings to really unravel and look at and talk about their implication. What I would offer is many times this whole question of health equity gets addressed in a board or a board executive retreat or offsite so that you can really dive into these. But if I were to just simply say, and this was with Karma's wisdom and judgment as well, these four questions are a good starting point. If we go to the next slide, this would be for that board that might be further along. If you're already tapping into the data and you're already asking those kinds of questions, this next level set of items is key. So I think one of the things that I'll share with you, just as an example, let's look at that second question. Do we make it easy for different patient demographic groups to use our services and discuss their experiences with our facility? I'll share a very simple little story. It happened to my dad when he was being taken to surgery for his first battle with cancer. He's speaking Spanish to us. I'm a PhD. My brother's a physician. My other brother is a state official in California. He was at the time. And my father had three grown children and my mom as advocates. And we're speaking Spanish. And he suddenly stops us and he says, "Stop, don't speak Spanish. They're going to think I'm stupid and they're not going to help me here." And my breath just fell out. I couldn't believe that he would think that and worry about that. And yet that was the beginning or the spark of potentially a health disparity. He had someone to help him. But this question about what it's like for different patient populations to be in your facility is an important one, because when there isn't a set of family advocates, language differences create enormous challenges for families and enormous risk. They're 49% more likely to experience of medical errors. 49% of them happen among individuals who are limited English proficient. So this is a safety issue. This is a community issue. This is your quality issue. And these have a little bit more texture to them for those of you who may have already started down the journey of building that health equity playbook. The last question is the one that I would say, I hope if there's one thing that we influence you today, is what are you holding yourself accountable to do? What are you holding yourself accountable for learning about the communities that you serve? Hopefully today you're getting a sense of the reality that this work is very vast and there's a lot to do. And it begins by asking tough questions. If you're not a member of a cultural group like Black and Brown families and say LGBTQ, you're looking at the work that you do through a certain lens. And I believe equity is a strategy. It's not something we put on for a moment and just say, oh, what might that be doing for a specific population? It should be the way of life. It should be a strategy. And so you as a board member have enormous responsibility for your own education about these issues and to really approach your role with that perspective. How do others experience this? How might we make this a more user-friendly environment? And what will be the net impact of that for us and for the communities that we serve? Karma, you want to add anything to that?
Oh, I think you've really brought us home well. And I thank everybody for your attention. We have just a few minutes, and I think that we'll perhaps see if there's any questions for us.
We do have a question from Karen. We are a mostly white community, but have economic disparities, which undoubtedly impact health outcomes. In small, racially homogeneous communities, does it make sense to target economic rather than cultural differences?
Yes, absolutely. Your zip code is a greater determinant of your overall health. And what do zip codes represent? Well, they represent class, economic opportunities. And so one of the things that we advocate is to actually look at patient utilization rates by zip code, not just by the ethnicity or real and SOGI data, because that will give you a further layer of understanding of what's happening among the patients that you serve. And yes, that would be important to do.
So if there aren't any other questions, are there? Sorry, Ryan.
You go ahead, Karma.
Okay, I was just going to say, if there aren't any other questions, I have a question for you, Dr. Hernandez. I think it's just fascinating because here you are an expert in health equity, and you also sit on the board of a health system in Northern California. So maybe if you wouldn't mind sharing a little bit about the journey that your board has taken in this area.
Sure. So I joined the board 5 years ago, and at that time, I began to just ask the questions that you're seeing on these slides. Why aren't we slicing the data in these ways? Why aren't we asking about patient experience by these demographic groups? And our hospital, Alameda Health System, is an essential hospital. At that time, we were looking at getting a new electronic health record that would be sort of not in the Smithsonian. And so we needed to bring it into the 21st century. That was a big barrier for us. And so we had to patiently kind of wait for the right time to begin what is now the Health Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion Task Force. And I'm co-chairing that with our CEO. I had to be patient, but I still would say that I kept asking about our commitment to health equity. We're in one of the most diverse parts of the Bay Area, and so it was always on my mind, and I brought it to the board's discussion. And it wasn't just me. There were others that were equally concerned. But the timing of having the electronic health record, which finally did get installed at the end of 2018, that allowed us to now begin to look at this data. I would say our CEO appreciates that I have a passion for this work because of personal concerns about this, but the ability to stay grounded in my role and not cross over to management is something that I'm really very much aware and know that it's important to respect. So I try to behave myself, let's put it that way.
Yes, and it sounds like you do. We've had conversations. So, what about this? I know, you know, having had the privilege of working in Washington State a fair amount, I know that many of the hospitals and many of the folks listening today are in small communities. They may be from critical access hospitals or rural hospitals. What would you suggest to them, given that they've usually got relatively flat organizational structures? You know, a chief health equity officer may not be an option. And of course, resources are tight.
Yeah, I definitely can appreciate that the rural hospitals face a very different set of challenges and barriers to doing this work. However, probably the one thing that you already know that is a determinant of health for your patient populations is transportation. When it takes hours to get to a site, when it's hard to navigate at a distance, what site is the right one to actually go to? Those opportunities, I think, are still just as important as the inner city environment where we're thinking about homelessness and food deserts and so on. Those can still be issues in rural sites. I would just say that your dashboard, your health equity playbook, may have very different priorities because of the realities of being in a rural environment or being small. So it's even more important for you to partner with neighboring towns, neighboring community organizations that are also possibly seeing the same population. So they come to you, but they go to a different organization maybe for some of their care or look for some assistance from other organizations. Your partnerships will help you bridge that distance. And I would just encourage that kind of conversation.
You know, that makes a lot of sense. And I realize one thing that we haven't mentioned in this webinar, I don't believe, is the connection to the community health needs assessment. And yeah, that as a really good tool to start with for any organization that wants to begin this conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. That's required every 3 years of a nonprofit hospital. You know that you're going to identify needs in that process. And if done well, you will be very much required to go speak with sort of stakeholders and different individuals that can comment on the health needs of a community. They may be subject matter experts, they may be other public health officials, but that is a wonderful place to begin to look at what those needs may be and to formulate a plan. It's required now that you actually use those to inform what your community improvement plan might look like. And it should be an opportunity to hear from those diverse voices that are part of your community.
Mm-hmm. That might be a way into this conversation if you're looking for one. And if you don't recall what's in your community health needs assessment or it's been a while, maybe just ask for that topic to be put on an upcoming board meeting and for a presentation of those results whenever they were, you know, whenever they were done sometime in the last 3 years. And then see where it goes and ask some of these questions perhaps about health equity.
Absolutely.
So I think we're just about at time and I want to be respectful of everybody's time. So I'm going to turn it back over to our colleagues, Ashley and Ryan.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you, Alyssa. Great job getting that up for us. Hi, Mike. Welcome. Comments on the presentation?
Very thorough and I think helpful. I think it raises some good questions for us as the board to ask. And I'm happy to say that I think we're right on target to answer a bunch of those questions with our outstanding health equity team at Jefferson Healthcare.
Great. Mike, would you like to add anything?
Well, I missed the beginning of the presentation, but it was fun seeing Karma again. I thought she did a good job framing the issues. I think it's always nice to have a content expert who is his deep knowledge of the topic, but also understands your role in that she's a board member for a hospital. So I thought that since this is kind of new work, that the outline was helpful, and I agree with Case. I think that it's a long road that we have started going down, and it's just a matter of keeping the work up and holding ourselves accountable and responding to community need. But that was helpful, interesting, and a validation of the energy that we're putting behind this, as well as an inspiration to continue.
It might be worth having a quarterly report on how some of the components of what the team is doing and how they're working. Maybe we could come up with a schedule for that and add it to the agenda on an appropriate basis when something is new or different.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, maybe at the next Health Equity Committee meeting, we'll talk about what that cadence should be. But it certainly should be more than an annual report, because there's a lot of work going on, and it's very dynamic right now. So maybe starting off quarterly would make sense. But you bet, happy to do that.
Great. All right, then. Yes, Bruce.
Yeah, I saw this presentation when it was live, and I'm not sure how long ago it was. It was back just when Case and I were first starting to talk about health equity, when we were working on our proposal and stuff. And it's interesting to see it again now and see how many of the things they talk about are being addressed in one way or another. So it was good to see it again.
That's great. Okay. All right, then, if there's no further discussion, then it is time for us to have our break, and we will recess now and return at 3:30. Thank you, everyone. Are we recording?
Yes, we're recording now.
Okay, thank you. Welcome back to the Jefferson County Public Hospital District No. 2 Board of Commissioners meeting on Wednesday, April 28th, 2021. Commissioner Kauf, would you like to begin our business session with your moment of silence?
Yes, thank you. I would like to request that we take a moment of silence. Here in Jefferson County, we've had three of our Jefferson County residents who have died because of COVID-19. In the United States, we've had 573,000 deaths from COVID-19. Worldwide, as of the beginning of this meeting, there were 3,140,000 deaths worldwide from COVID-19. And India is currently in the most horrific state of a pandemic that is totally out of control in a country of 1.4 billion people, less than 10% of whom are vaccinated. And they apparently yesterday they had 361,000 new confirmed cases. And the guess is that anywhere from 10 to 20 times that is the actual number of cases, which means that yesterday, as many as 5, 6, 7 million people acquired COVID-19 in India. So I would love for us to take just a moment of silence to remember all of those who have died so far with this pandemic.
All right.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Case. Well done. We will now continue with our business session. And first of all, we welcome our new Chief Financial Officer, Tyler Freeman. He will have a proper introduction when CEO Mike Glenn presents our financial report. But meanwhile, welcome aboard, Mr. Freeman. So now we will go to our patient story with Tina Toner, our Chief Nursing Officer.
Thank you. Good afternoon. The patient story that I have for you this afternoon is really touching, and it's being shared with permission from our patient and their family. So the picture that you are viewing is one that was sent in from a family member in recognition of the care provided by Dr. Nauman in our hospital. And I'd like to read the accompanying note which came with the picture. Dr. Nauman, I have enclosed a picture of you and my mom. After you put my mom back together, we were able to enjoy two more years where she could still walk. She felt that was a huge gift, and I do too. She spent the last 8 months of her life in hospice. Her head was still there, and she told every doctor and nurse how you saved her life. My mom passed away January 20th of this year. She wanted me to thank you for everything that you did. You are sincerely appreciated. So a big thank you to Dr. Nauman, and I think a good reminder to all of us of just how significant the care we provide is to our patients and their well-being. That's all I have.
That's excellent.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any comments from the board? All right, then we will move on to the minutes. Our March 24th regular session minutes. Is there a motion to approve, please?
So moved.
Second.
All right, any discussion? All in favor say aye, please.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Chair votes aye. Unanimous. Required approvals. Anything that anyone would like us to take out? Or if not, then may I have a motion to accept?
So moved.
Second. All right. It's moved and seconded. Any discussion?
No. All in favor? For the credentials.
Okay. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Okay. Unanimous. We will now go on with our financial report with our Chief Executive Officer, Mike Glenn. Welcome, Mike.
Welcome. Thank you. I will be presenting today's financial report and next month turning it over to Tyler. So as Bruce noted at the conclusion of the last meeting, I'm actually going to set a very low bar to make sure Tyler can absolutely clear it with respect to the comprehensiveness of his presentation. Next slide, please. Actually, before I go into operating statistics, I'll speak a little bit about Tyler and introduce him to the board. Tyler comes from Kootenai Medical Center in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. He served in a leadership position in both the Kootenai Medical Center Hospital Finance Department and more recently a leadership position in the Finance Department of the Kootenai Health Network and Population Health Division of Kootenai Medical Center. Part of our interest in Tyler is that he was working very closely with the managed care and different approaches to providing care and different financial models with Kootenai, similarly to the work that we did with our ACO. So we thought that that was an excellent experience for us. Prior to Kootenai, Tyler worked for a healthcare auditing firm and audited several small critical access hospitals in Eastern Washington and relative Northwest part of the country. Tyler is a CPA. He has an undergraduate degree from Eastern Washington and an MBA from Boise State. So I think Tyler moved his family over to Port Townsend a couple weeks ago, and is busy at work and busy settling into the community, and we couldn't be happier to have him on board. So you will get to know him much better in the coming weeks and months, and certainly at the next board meeting. So welcome.
Thanks, Tyler. Mike. I do want to have the record show that my undergrad is from Washington State University, though. Go Cougs.
I think that's like the third time I've introduced him from Eastern. Sorry, man.
No worries.
Yeah, my daughter goes to the UW, so I just have a hard time
saying. You can't say those words.
Well, I do, yeah. Okay, next slide, please. So the first thing you will note about March is that there is more green in March than there was in February. The surgery lab, diagnostic imaging, and PT and rehab, and the clinics were all at or above budget. That is a big chunk of our revenue budget. So when those areas are green or close to green, it usually bodes well for the rest of the hospital. The inpatient units, the emergency department, and pharmacy meds dispensed were below budget. And pharmacy meds dispensed is impacted by patient census, maybe more than anything else. Pharmacy continues to be very busy on an outpatient basis, but when we have low inpatients, those drugs that would be dispensed are affected. So overall, a fairly busy month and much busier than February. Next slide, please. So that shows up on the revenue sheet. The gross revenue line, top revenue line of $26,193,000. $1,588 compares favorably not only to budget of $24,500,000, but to February, where I think that number was about $20,500,000. So a significant increase from last month. Revenue adjustments all told came in at about half of what the gross patient service revenue is. I will bring your attention to the charity care adjustments. That number was just shy of $400,000 compared to a budget of $233,000. So 72% over budget this month. And if you go all the way to the right hand of the screen, we're running 44% above budget for charity care. So I think we spoke a little bit last week about a changing external environment that we are beginning to understand and contemplate how that may impact the organization going forward. So all told, net patients service revenue, $12,839,000, a little bit of other revenue, and for total operating revenue of $13,381,505,000, and that compares favorably to the budget by about 14%. Salary and wages, I think, were managed better than last month. Again, I spent some time talking about just the difficulty of managing expenses when you have a month for one reason or another of such low volumes. I mean, we are a large organization now, and it's very difficult to scale down to the degree you have to scale down when I think total operating revenue was below $9 million last month. We did a fine job of managing labor this last month. The one thing I will note is in other expenses, supplies was about $750,000 over budget, and we think that's mostly because of an increasing pharmaceutical spend, both for work that we're doing in specialty drugs and medical oncology drugs, but also the growing of our 340B program, which that inventory actually is part of our inventory. And then we route through the participating pharmacies and it converts to revenue. So the total operating income for the month was just over $1 million, $1,040,712, for an operating margin of 7.8%. Much better than last month. Month to date, we still are $550,000 in the red and $1.5 million off of budget. But this month was much better than last month. Next slide, please.
Mike?
Yeah.
Since I was a little bit teasing you last month, I feel I need to say something, because if you go back to the last slide, mm-hmm. and if you look at the quarter compared to last year, and last year we had 2 months before COVID. So if you look at some of the changes of first 3 months this year compared to first 3 months last year, I mean, when you look at total operating revenue, I mean, we're $3.7 million ahead of last year for the first 3 months. And then if you look at the change in net compared to last year, I mean, we're about $1.2 million better than last year. So
that's true.
March this year really made a big difference, Mike. And you were still in there. You're doing a good job.
So. All right. Well, good. Well, thank you. Yeah. I was reflecting. I actually was meeting with Tyler today, and I was reflecting back to when we started to feel COVID. And I think it was middle part of March when the governor's prohibition on elective services began and really started to impact volumes. It's nice that's behind us. So thank you, Bruce. Next slide. So this is our cash slide. And the number we pay most attention to is the kind of orange number, the second highest number that shows 115 days. That's actual cash that does not include Medicare advance payment. The green number on the top of the graph is reflects the advance payment that we received from Medicare as just basically a loan. Interestingly, that is supposed to be clawed back beginning in April, and we haven't seen that occur yet. We were talking today about just, are we going to see that in the form of higher contractual allowances or just less reimbursement? But it's probably going to throw a curveball into our financial reporting. We'll be monitoring that cash line. And over the course of, I think, like 6 to 9 months is sort of the repayment period. We'll watch that number, and it won't go below the orange number, whatever that is. We worked hard with our congressional delegation trying to convince them to provide some relief on paying back the advance payment. Some hospitals in the state, the delta between their cash with advance payment in it and their just cash line is much tighter. And they are concerned that when Medicare starts clawing back that loan, that they have already spent it. So that's work that WSHA is beginning to do now. Next slide, please. Here is the board financial report. Not a whole lot to report here. Some audit fees, and just usual expenses. Next slide, please. And here's April. I mean, as soon as we got line of sight on March and got a feeling that it was going to be okay, we really focused on April. April's a spring break month. When I review some volumes later on in the board meeting, you'll see a couple of months where specialty clinics and primary care clinic volumes were lower because of opportunities to go take some time off when the kiddos out of school. So we were pretty focused on doing what we had to do to make April work and have it look more like March than February. And it's nice to see it tracking at 102% of budget, cash collections hanging in there, and 45 days in AR. So that concludes the finance presentation. I'm happy to answer any questions now or later on in the meeting, but much better month than February.
Good job. Any questions from the board or?
No, very glad to see it. And I think it's maybe it's a welcome for Tyler that he didn't have to deal with February.
Yeah.
Those are excellent points you brought out too, Bruce. That was, and Mike. It's great. All right, then thank you, Mike, very much for that great report. You made our day. So we'll move on now to the quality report from Brandy Manuel. She is our Chief Patient Safety and Quality Officer. Brandy?
Good afternoon. Thank you for your time today. And Alyssa, can we go to the next slide? So we will do our usual patient safety and quality overview today, taking a look at last month's quality performance. We'll take kind of a deeper dive under the hood and see what flows into some of that data. And then, as we always do, we'll take a look at some of the feedback we've had from our patients in the last month, and we'll round it out by taking a look at current projects. Next slide. All right, so last month looked fairly good. My goal one of these days is to show one of these reports that is green across the board, but March was not it. So we did have, unfortunately, one surgical site infection, which we'll talk about in just a minute. Otherwise, though, things did look fairly good. We still have our times to CT for stroke is a little bit longer than we want to see it, though we are making good progress, and the average time kind of overall is decreasing, which is great. So we're headed in the right direction. All right, next slide. So taking a look at kind of the data that falls under the hood, if we think about this in terms of patient safety metrics, this looks like a really boring report, but actually it's boring because it's great. So you see these little gray arrows, which indicate there really is no change kind of across the board month over month. So this is a comparison of February to March. And what we see is that we did not have any reportable adverse drug events in the three categories that we report on, that our antimicrobial stewardship days of therapy remain about where they have been. We did have one fall with injury, which was a patient who was ambulating to the restroom, had a staff member with them, and then sort of slipped while they were in the bathroom. They had a scratch to the knee, but otherwise no harm. Patient did okay, but a scratch qualifies as harm, so that gets counted. No changes in our C. diff or catheter-associated urinary tract infection rates. No change in our central line associated bloodstream infection rates, all good. And then it's interesting, so you see here the change in urinary catheter, that's catheter use as opposed to the CODI rate, which is the infection control. So that just means that there were, that the number of catheters in use was up a little bit, but no harm associated with that. Our last catheter-associated urinary tract infection was from June of 2020. And then that surgical site infection doesn't show up here. You'll notice it says zero. There's a little bit of a data lag with the NHSN, which is the national repository where we report our data and we're compared against others. And so it doesn't show up here just yet, but it did occur in March. And if we go to the next slide, I wanted to be able to kind of show an overview of generally these are our infection rates. So that one really scary looking spike right there is actually from March of 2020, which was our last surgical site infection. It was a knee And so it's we made it about a year before we had our next surgical site infection, which was also a knee. There are things that we do to prevent those infections, and those are listed off to the right. And in this particular case, this patient was well cared for. The infection was actually recognized fairly quickly, but he did get sick and ended up having to be readmitted. So the team took great care of him while he was here, and he's done okay. But we definitely never want to see people have to come back to the hospital after surgery. So any questions before I go on? All right, next slide.
Yeah, quick question. This is Case. I'm sure it's very difficult to figure out how to deal with small numbers. You know, when you have a small hospital, you don't get that efficiency of scale, and then one number just sort of throws things off totally. Or one bad outcome. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the number of knee procedures that we do, because as I understand it, we are becoming relatively well known as a place to get your knees fixed.
Yeah, so we do many more knees than we certainly did a few years ago. And while the number isn't quite as high as those areas like the Swedish Orthopedic Institute or other larger organizations, it definitely has increased. And I don't have, this is the rate, and it was one infection. Let me get that for you, and I'll circle back if that works. But we have that denominator data, and I can pull it out for you.
Great. Thank you.
All right, next slide. And here, so we're seeing a little bit of a shift in the kind of feedback that we're getting from our patients. For a while, we were getting a lot of feedback about COVID, and we're starting to see less about that. And where we have some opportunities for improvement is really more around communication with our patients, timely response, and time to kind of appointment, whether it's with a specialist or an ancillary test. Folks are giving us feedback that we may have some opportunity to look at that. But I did see we had a few sort of noteworthy comments from our patients, and those are kind of highlighted in blue. So as usual, great feedback on our providers and the care that they're being given. And I loved, you know, I may have a little bit of a bias, but I think some of our entrance screeners are amazing, and it's kind of hard work to be right up there up front. So I love that the last bullet point notes that it said the girls, but that those who are working at the entrance screening station were excellent. It's nice that somebody took the time to kind of call that out. And then next slide. So here's just a handful of our current projects. We already talked about the time to CT for our stroke patients. I think that you heard a great presentation earlier on health equity. What's exciting with the work that's being done around our health equity team is that we really are beginning to layer in within our quality data and our outcome data information that will help us assess where we may have some opportunity for improvement or health disparities in outcomes. And so more and more you'll start to see that kind of layered in with some of our quality reporting, which is pretty exciting. And then just a quick note that we have a chief of surgery transition. Dr. Mattern may mention this in his report, but Dr. Naumann has served as our chief of surgery for the last couple of years and has done a great job. And so we thank him for his service. And he, effective May 1st, is handing over the reins to Dr. Mitra Jafari, who will serve as our interim chief of surgery until the next sort of election cycle. So welcome to Dr. Jafari, and thanks to Dr. Naumann for his last couple years of service. And then just more ongoing quality work. The Express Clinic did a great job with their reaccreditation a few weeks ago, just landing with one item that we'll need to follow up with, but otherwise they did a great job working with Jake and our lab team to get ready for our upcoming CAP survey. And then Laura Showers is working with our team to look at our certification from DNV in hip and knee replacement. So that's all really exciting work going on. Next slide. That's all I have. Any questions?
No questions? Right.
Okay. No, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. And Commissioner Koff, I will pull those denominators for you and I'll put them in the chat for you.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
All right. We'll move on then to Mike again and with his administrative report.
I actually have those numbers. Jen and I were talking about orthopedic volumes earlier in the week. We did 120 total knees in 2019. 92 in 2020. So round up to 100 and it's pretty easy to do the math. And if Randy, if I don't have first quarter of 2021, that's what we'll work to get for you, Case. Okay, next slide. So I am grotesquely violating Karma's rule of thumb on number of slides. So my apologies in advance. My way to manage that is that I will just sort of gallop through these. And this will probably be the last time I use this format where I go over test data, PPE data, kind of the things that were maybe more important 6 months ago than they are now. But what I will do is just fly through these, maybe point out something of interest, but not spend a whole lot of time on these slides until we get to the space expansion slide. So next slide, please. Testing update almost up to 19,000. What I will say is that the CDC is becoming more comfortable with recommending or allowing organizations and communities to have a different standard for vaccinated patients than vaccinated patients. And right now we test before every procedure, vaccinated or not, we will do a COVID test to rule out COVID. That results in the majority of the total COVID tests is fairly complicated to manage and arrange, and in most cases does not come with reimbursement. It's just a best infection control practice. We will be reviewing that now that the CDC is beginning to hint at maybe that's not necessary for vaccinated patients. So if that were the case, and the doctors Mattern, Harris, and Butterfield recommend scaling that down, you will likely see the testing numbers decline. Next slide, please.
If I could add, Mike. Also, that will change, hopefully change the positivity rate. I mean, if you're going around and doing all of this testing of people who are vaccinated, you're not going to get very many positive. So it makes that number rather meaningless.
Yeah, that's a good point. The only thing I'll say about our PPE inventory is that we have loads of it. We're in very good, very strong shape. With N95 masks, and Kelly, there are other organizations who aren't in as strong of shape, and what we are considering keeping our place in the allotment line, but redirecting our weekly allotment to those other organizations, so that if and when the day comes around where we need to reclaim that allotment, we will reserve the right to do so, but we don't need to add to our N95 stockpile right now. And there are some organizations, I suspect those in Seattle or where hospitalizations are increasing, might need them. So Kelly's in conversations with our suppliers and with those other organizations. It seems like a reasonable and friendly thing to do. Next slide, please. Healthcare volumes. This is the phone line and clinic visit volumes, and the blue and the gold. And then on the right is the respiratory clinic volumes that beginning 1st of March, we have embedded the respiratory clinics into the Express clinic. Next slide, please. Primary care and specialty clinic, you'll note the two middle bars below budget. Those were the spring break weeks, so we anticipated that, but back over 100% for the middle week of April. Next slide, please. Oncology.
Mike, could you go back one, two slides, please? Just the respiratory, I was interested in the respiratory clinic volumes. Am I seeing a trend there of increasing volumes? That I'm curious as to what's going on there.
The aqua blue captures the drive-through test station. So what that probably is capturing is the increasing surgical procedures and increasing dental procedures, and because the information that we stare at actually breaks it down for procedure related and symptomatic, and the vast majority are procedure related. So that's probably what that growth is capturing.
Okay, thanks.
Yep. Oncology surgical case volumes over budget, with the aqua blue being surgical services and the lighter grayish kind of color endoscopy procedures. Next slide. And this is the ED and Express clinic volume, and climbing up a little from end of last year, still about 20% off budget. And Dunya is drilling down on understanding. In fact, that might be something the board might be interested in. We've actually broken down a comparison of the types of cases that we saw in 2019 versus the type of cases we saw in 2020. And we can point to the diagnoses and the severity of patients not showing up. And interestingly, respiratory disease represents a big chunk of the patients not showing up. And when you think about maybe the only good thing about COVID and our reaction to COVID is that it kind of smashed the flu outbreak. I don't think we recorded one flu case in the entire quarter. Interesting.
Mike, I wonder if a lack of tourism, lack of visitors from elsewhere who would maybe see care at the Express Clinic, would that be a factor here?
Possibly. Next slide. This is our COVID vaccination slide that we spent a lot of time looking at. Numbers now over 22,000 total shots. Next slide. Some additional information. And
Mike, those are shots given by Jefferson Healthcare.
Correct, yeah.
Okay. And yes. Does that still represent perhaps 90% of what's given in the county?
It was hovering at 80%. Roughly, and Dunya hates when I do this, but about 10% other Jefferson County providers, and about 10% folks leaving the county, grabbing a shot wherever they could, particularly for the first 3 months. But we haven't looked at that in the last couple of weeks. Since we commonly say that we represent about 80% of the total vaccination count, that should be something that we check on a regular basis, and we will. Next slide, please. Okay. This is the follow-up to last week's presentation on space expansion, I think I said that My goal for tonight is to go through the problem that we think we need to solve and identify the resources to take us through the first phase of that due diligence, assign an estimated cost to that, and then recommend that we proceed. But again, I spoke last month of our work with Coates and Associates and Health Facilities Planning to oversee the master site planning process. Lots of input, medical staff, hospital staff, community, and the goal was to address necessary facility improvements, identify expansion needs. Jody's focus was identify areas of patient outmigration or where our community was growing into being able to justify new services, and also just understand the overall community sentiment toward Jefferson Healthcare. Next slide. And this is a very busy slide. It's basically the two slides that I showed last week all crammed into one. And it takes us from everything from, work that I'll speak to in a moment about expanding diagnostic imaging capacity and potentially the new building to accommodate several new services and ambulatory surgical suites. And then it just takes us down the other needs that the process identified, from retrofitting the 1988 building to meet current life and safety codes, adding a linear accelerator vault to provide radiation therapy treatment to our patients, the 65 building, the building that I'm in right now, replacement and expansion. And then as kind of a big, bold goal, a community-driven, or actually two projects in one or two separate projects, a primary care facility to provide improved space for our primary care providers, and either somewhat attached to that or in proximity to that, a wellness center that could include anything and everything that the community feels that belongs in a wellness center. So that's the big long list. All of that came out of the master site planning process. What I am recommending that we do is that we chop that plan into four phases. And I'm going to focus on the first two phases, or phase one and 2A, next. So next slide, Melissa. So initially we thought that there was considerable need to improve the throughput in surgery because of filling.
Excuse me, Mike. I think we're behind one slide. Your discussion isn't corresponding with the slide. So, Alyssa, I think we need to catch up here.
So are you seeing the slide that's titled Phase 1 and 2A in front of you now?
No. Yes. I see four-phase master site. There we go. Now I see Phase 1 and 2A.
Must be a slow internet case.
Oh, my God. All right. It matches my brain speed. That's okay.
The first phase one really were projects that we looked around. I identified what we thought were pent up demand, and how could we meet that pent up demand in the most accelerated way possible. So initially we thought we needed to increase pre-op and post-op space because we thought that was leading to patient throughput issues in the operating room. And so Tina began a project where she looked at that and what that work would look like and how much it would cost. and also worked with Bill and the rest of the team down there to really understand how critical that need was. And one, determined that it was significantly more expensive than we anticipated. And two, also concluded that it wasn't a project that we needed to move forward on immediately. So our recommendation is to defer that work until we get through the first phase of the due diligence of the project that may include additional ambulatory surgery centers. It's possible that we may not have to do this before, if we proceed with adding 3 or 4 ambulatory surgery center suites into our system. So if that's the case, we would prefer not to make that investment. If Tina and Bill and our surgeons conclude, nope, our volumes are rising, we need to increase throughput to accommodate patient care until additional suites are put online, then we will revisit and march forward. But for now, that project is deferred. The second project is to expand diagnostic imaging capacity with a real emphasis on improving access to women's breast care and introducing breast MRI and stereotactic biopsy capability. So Jake has been working with Aaron Ballett and Randy. And we brought in Coates to see what minor tweaks would be required in the diagnostic imaging center that's right by the main lobby. And they have a rough plan on what would need to occur in order to allow for that to happen. So we've met with medical staff leadership, and I presented at medical staff meetings about the possibility of us increasing access to mammo, adding a stereotactic biopsy system as another tool in our breast care toolkit, and acquiring a MRI breast coil that would allow us to do breast MRIs. And it was very well received by nearly all sections of the medical staff. So we are considering moving forward with that. We are nailing down the economics of purchasing the equipment. We very much would like the foundation to help us in fundraising for these very important and very necessary, and my hunch is, very supportable services. So we began discussions in that area. But that's very exciting. It will truly introduce two new modalities of women's breast care into our community, and it already is introducing increased and improved access to mammograms in our community. So we are pleased about that. And the estimated cost for the improvements that we think we will be able to do, the construction improvements, are $50,000 to $100,000. That does not include the technology improvements or acquisitions that we are still working on the price, and we will present those costs to you most likely next meeting.
So and then could I ask a quick question on that,
yeah,
please? So this is remodeling existing space. Is that correct? What this cost would?
Yeah.
Okay.
Relatively minor, moving a couple of walls around, but that's what those things cost these days.
And we've got the space to actually do that?
Yep.
All right.
And then the Phase 2A would be the idea of of adding the new building in order to accommodate additional space for our women's clinic, our dermatology clinic, outpatient surgery centers, and a few other potential specialty services that I'll go over in a moment. So next slide, please. So the problems that we were trying to solve, as I mentioned last month, we all knew that the clinic for our women's or the space for our women's clinic was a space holder, that it was available, and we could immediately expand the program with Dr. Skorborg and Dr. Luckman. And we have been overwhelmed with how well the program is being received and the impact that they are having on women's both medical and surgical care in our community. It's a pretty ambitious budget, and they are operating at 115% of budget year to date. To give you some idea of just how cramped they are, there are times where there's three providers and there's five exam rooms. And for specialists, three rooms per provider is optimal. Between two and three is really necessary for practices that turn patients over quickly. And I think most importantly, the quality of this space does not represent the value and the importance of the service line. I mean, whether you like to admit that or not, that matters. We believe that that is one of the most important service lines that we can provide to our community, and it needs to be done in a space that is representative of that commitment. In addition, provide additional space for our growing dermatology clinic. The practice is operating at 123 of budget, so it continues to grow. Clinic has seven exam rooms, but two of those exam procedure rooms are for Mohs, and I don't think they see patients in them. Maybe they figured out how to do that, but that is a very busy and cramped space right now, and we have been looking for an additional provider for months. Thought we were very close to finding one a couple months back, but and when that was occurring, Dr. Haycox came to me and said, you know, okay, if we're successful at finding another provider, then we're going to have to figure out where to put that provider. And I said, Claire, I got a plan. You'll be squished for a while, but we'll figure it out. In order for us to continue to meet the growing demand of our community and a dermatologist, I think in Kitsap County that was very popular, has closed down that practice. So that's making this surge of patients even more dramatic. But our interest is creating space for a growing, really regional dermatology practice. And once that occurs, we will then build out the derm hallway, which is connected to the medical oncology practice, and use those exam rooms for additional medical oncology exam rooms, which that practice desperately needs. So it comes together in a fairly reasonable way if all this were to come to fruition. Next slide, please. We will also continue to review the data and work with the medical group about potentially adding additional specialty services that are currently underserved in our community. Neurology, for the last two or three analyses that Jody has done for us, have demonstrated that our community can support a neurologist. The same is true for pulmonology. And those are two practices that would work, services that would work very well with our community. The highest source of out-migration in Jefferson County, interestingly, is for ENT services, but a lot of those are for kiddos. And because of our limited capability of taking care of pediatric patients in the hospital, we would have to be thoughtful about how we moved forward with introducing an ENT service to Jefferson County. But because it is such a high source of patients leaving our community, I suspect we'll go through that exercise, and ultimately the decision will be based on will come from our medical staff leaders, and determining if we can take care of any emergency that may come from a simple tube procedure, and then develop state of the art ambulatory surgical suites to expand operating room capacities. Not only is this a solution to we're going to need more OR rooms, but it's a far more cost-effective solution than figuring out where and how to add operating room suites in the hospital-based OR. And also, if you've had experiences of getting an outpatient procedure in an outpatient setting versus a hospital setting, they're just designed differently. Outpatient surgical suites are designed for ambulatory patients that may only be there for an hour or an hour and a half. So everything from registration to pre-op procedure and post-op is done with that in mind. That is the predominant procedure that we do now, outpatient procedures. So it might be interesting to lend that bias into the design of these suites. And lastly, Jake and I are becoming, I won't say experts, but we are learning a lot about what's happening in this space. And insurance companies, in many cases, are requiring surgical cases to be done in an outpatient surgery center environment because of the cost differential. So it's a little complicated when it's a hospital-based outpatient surgery center, but I think we need to be mindful as we move into this value-based healthcare world of developing the most cost-effective value-oriented care environments as possible, because our costs are our costs, and we pass those on to our community as responsibly as we can. But I think we've all, on a handful of occasions over the years, people will show up to the board meeting and challenge us to be able to match our prices, which are a reflection of our cost, should match prices, which are a reflection of the cost of a completely different care environment. So a little bit of that thinking is going into this facility. Next slide, please. So this is what the 90-day due diligence process will look like. We've engaged a DZA to perform a comprehensive financial analysis to determine the viability of the project. This analysis will be identical to the viability analysis that they performed prior to the ESSB project. We've engaged Jeff Fivecoat, the Director of Public Finance for Piper Sandler, to identify the most sensible debt options and negotiate the most favorable terms of finding capital for this project. If that name sounds familiar, it's because he did this work for us with the ESSB project, and at that time recommended going the USDA route. He is not recommending that route now because there still is a significant amount of work and costs associated with going through that application process, but the spread between the interest rate they could deliver and the interest rate that the private market can deliver is not that great. So the cost of mostly the DZA project for the next 90 days, and the completion of that financial analysis we estimate to be about $15,000. Jake will be leading the operational analysis at this point, pulling in different representatives from the medical group, but we will be working with Jody to mostly update the provider needs assessment and specialty services market share work that she did for the master site plan. And not only are we going to have her just update and drill down on the services that may go into this building, but we're going to just have her update that for all services in the hospital, because I suspect in the next year we will be talking about what new services we may need to add in the ADA expansion project, or maybe even in the much larger primary care facility if that comes to fruition. So the estimate of Jody's work is about $10,000, and it, you know, it, we will ask her to help us understand how busy a neurologist or a neurologist team would be if we were to introduce them to our community, and what type of procedures would they do. Next slide, please. And the last resource is the project manager. And you may remember Dick Bratton, who was project manager for us at the last project. And we learned many things at the completion of the ESSB project. One lesson was that we brought Dick Bratton, or project manager, on board too late. Jake and Erin have been working, spoke with a couple of project managers and have identified this outfit that kind of specializes in the design build project model. Now, up until about 10 years ago, the only way a public hospital district could build a project is to hire an architect, design a building, go out to bid, accept the lowest cost bid, and then spend the next 18 months fighting with the contractor for any and all changes that we instigate, or changes that they identify as a unanticipated condition. And that model can be crazy making, because it doesn't feel like you are sitting at the same side of the table. It feels very adversarial. It's a zero sum game, there is very little collaboration. 10 years ago, the AWA PhD approached the legislature and said, you know, there's a better way. Public hospital districts should be able to build projects like Swedish, Virginia Mason, and other non-public hospital districts, where you actually bring on a design team, kind of get an idea of what you want, then you bring on a contractor, and then you tuck together and collectively design it. So you've got the contractor and the architect at the same time looking at a space to be designed and agreeing on what the most sensible way is to do it. So unknown conditions, I'm going to have to charge you $1,000 for that sink because you failed to specify it in the plans. All that stuff goes away. And I wish I was being sarcastic, but I'm not. It's those are the type of things that just make you want to pull your hair out when you aren't, when your goals aren't aligned. A condition that the legislature included in permitting public hospital districts to go this route is that for your first project, you have to have a project manager that has experience at design build. And OCH has that experience. They served in this capacity for the lovely medical office building that was recently built in Shelton for Mason. They come very highly recommended. So we are recommending that begin with us now, work the first for the first 90 days of this due diligence, help us understand the viability of what we want to build, the most optimal site, do some high level budget validating, and just begin us down that path that helps us better understand if what we want to do makes sense from a construction perspective. My plan, and so their cost is about $50,000 to $75,000, depending on how fast and hard we go with them. So my recommendation is that we move forward with these three consultants and spend the next 90 days completing this due diligence, and then coming back to you at the July board meeting with an update on what we've learned, the conclusions we've reached, and sort of where we go from here. That will, if we decide to proceed, will likely require an additional spend. But for the first phase of this due diligence process, I anticipate a spend of about no more than $100,000. And the last thing I'll say before I ask if there's any questions, that this will be a, if we continue to do the project, this will be work that will be embedded in the project. So it's like a down payment on the continuation of the work that the project manager and the subsequent design team would do.
Right. So Mike, are you looking for a motion?
You know, technically, I don't need a motion, but this is a big spend, and I wanted to make sure you understood what it entails and what the deliverable is, and that basically we're going to spend up to $100,000 to flush out this this potentially $25 million building, and report back to you with more details in July.
I think we could come to a consensus what do you say, board members?
I'll move that we support Mike's plan for phase one on this project.
Bruce?
Agree.
Okay. Mari?
Yes, complete agreement.
And I don't see Matt. Matt, are you there?
Yeah, I'm right here. Looks
okay,
good to me.
Okay, and the chair agrees, so.
Okay.
Great, sounds good.
Thanks. Could I ask one quick question?
Yep.
Going to report also back on the best site as well. It has the site for this been specifically identified yet?
Not specifically. We have a couple of possible sites, and the one that we like the most is right where the portable is. So right across the street from the vaccination center, that it's close to the hospital, close to surgery. And these are the assumptions we're going to test. But right off the main drive, enough room for some parking, but that's one site that we probably will start with, that comes from the building site consulting firm of Glenn and Davidson, and what the hell do we know about that? It seems like that would fit in well, but we're going to bring in the experts to validate that recommendation.
And at the same time, get a broad picture of the larger build out for the master plan, so that it's not competing with other needs 5, 10 years from now.
No, that's a great point, Case. The fourth leg of this process, we will have to really understand before we green light this project, is how sensibly it fits in with the 65 hospital replacement project. Because right. some of you may have seen a concept drawing of a big two-story building that actually was built on columns over the ESSB parking lot. What nearly one floor of that concept included the services that we are putting in this building. So our belief is, and we would confirm this, is that by investing in this building, we are reducing the investment in the 65 replacement project, and particularly on the clinical side. But I don't think we'd want to push dirt over here until we had a really good understanding of how the 65 building will be replaced, and what the services in the 88 building will be. So lots of work. Okay, well, thank you. Next slide, please. So here's an issue that we've been concerned about for the last couple of months, and we are now getting in front of the city and the county, and that is the parking challenge that will occur when OLECAP begins their the project to develop those 41 or so affordable housing units. To the left of the slide, the red blocks, that's the QFC parking lot right now. And that's precisely where this housing project is going to go. So if you drive by there on any given day, that lot is full of Jefferson Healthcare employees. And actually, we will even fill about a third of the lot in front of the county office space in the QFC public works office space in the QFC expanded area on the Sheridan Street side. So when that construction project works begins, they will certainly tear up the QFC lot where our slots are. And our thinking is that the space that they will need in order to phase the project will take a big chunk of the additional parking spaces away. So it's going to confound Jefferson Healthcare. It's going to confound Jefferson Public Health and Public Works. So our recommendation is that the city allow us to develop a temporary lot to get us past the vaccination clinic parking disruption, and then help both the hospital and the hospital and the county mitigate the parking challenge of the affordable housing project. And you can see the proposed temporary use area with the red slot or red arrow. That is just on the Sims Street side of the Manresa Castle. And we are recommending that we develop a temporary lot, a parking lot on that dirt. We fronted $50,000 to the county in order to pay for new surfacing and new lights on the QFC lot to make that a better lot for our employees. And we're only in about a year and a half of that 5-year lease. So the county is going to give us 30 some odd thousand dollars back as a refund, because we didn't use all of the money that we front loaded. And we were planning on using most of that to develop this lot. Next slide.
That's what I was going to ask, Mike. Are we getting money back from them? Good. Thank you.
Yeah. And this is that's a close up of the lot. It's a fairly significant lot. And Aaron is working with the city of Port Townsend to discuss about it. You know, does this meet the emergency or not emergency temporary use criteria? Because we would not be investing in, you know, all of the infrastructure, stormwater drain improvements that if we were building this as a permanent lot, we would be required to do.
Do we have any idea how long we would be using this lot?
Probably 2 years. Certainly as long as it takes for them to build the housing unit and the QFC lot. And then our project might be going on at that point, so we may need to continue to use it. So it seems to meet the criteria of a temporary use, but it's less about our definition and more about the city of Port Townsend. So I think tomorrow we're going to make formal application for the temporary use permit, and I will let you know how that goes at the next meeting. We're going to have to do something. I don't think everybody fully appreciates the impact that very, very needed a project is going to have on this area.
Will that space accommodate the parking that is currently being used?
Yes. Yeah, I think it's like over 100 spaces in the temporary parking lot. So I will come back to you with in July with hopefully the money we got back from the county was just what we needed in order to create this permanent or this temporary parking lot. If that's not the case, I may come to you with some potential other solutions because we're going to have to do something. Next slide, please. And then advocacy update. We had a great call with Derek Kilmer a couple weeks ago. Derek was kind enough to snap this team shot of Dunya and I and his office and give us a shout out in his weekly newsletter, particularly congratulating us on our vaccination effort. And then secondly, Dunya and I did not miss the opportunity to pitch Comma to him again. And they still very interested. He actually thinks that there's more of an appetite for Comma now because a lot of small critical access hospitals are on their knees and really struggling. Some critical access hospitals are actually divesting from services like home health because of the non cost-based reimbursement and the cost report penalty that you take. That's not Jefferson Healthcare. Let me be real clear about that. But that a regional hospital just did that within the last month for those reasons. And I'm confident that critical access hospital would do a better job in a more integrated fashion if it were running home health. But because of that penalty and the non-cost-based reimbursement, they were just losing too much money doing it. So we're going to make a strong pitch again. And for Mari and Jill, and I think Case who went back there, there's big table issues and small table issues. The big table issues are the issues that WSHA identifies and that the entire group presents to Senators Cantwell and Murray and representatives. And then the small table issues are kind of hospital specific issues, and we go and get in front of the legislative aides of the congressmen. WSHA has told us that Comma will be a big table issue in September, either virtual or going back there in person, because they feel that the timing is right and that we need to raise it to a higher level and we might gain some traction. And again, what Comma is it's our idea in which to allow hospital, paid critical access hospitals, cost-based reimbursement for services like home health, hospice, skilled nursing facility, ambulance, psych, inpatient psychiatric, inpatient substance abuse, all of the services that almost always or frequently aren't provided by critical access hospitals just because of the financial disincentive. I mean, if you want to fix access to those services, that's what you do. You don't, you know, that's what you do. And so we're pretty focused on continuing to pound on that.
Mike, do you happen to have a one-page summary yeah. of that?
Yep.
That you would send out to everyone?
Absolutely. Yep. Dunia has done great work in that area, and we sure will. Next slide, please. And lastly, I saw this on the internet, and I thought it was kind of cool because, you know, we've looked at individual markers, success markers for our COVID response, but I've never saw something that just sort of ticked off a bunch of things that Jefferson County was doing and then compared us to the rest of the state. So this was about a week old, but it not only gives us the metric in Jefferson County, but it talks about the how we rate in the rest of the state. And I thought that it was a good way to kind of assess much of the work that we're doing as a community and compare it to the other counties in the state. So I thought it was a good slide to end on. And that concludes my presentation. I apologize for it being so long, but I wanted to spend as much time as needed talking about the space expansion plan because that could be a big deal down the road.
Would you mind putting that last slide up again, because it never made it to my internet?
Huh. Maybe you could take.
Thank you. That one did. Thank you. Now I see it.
That would be a good one to share with us too. Hard copy okay. if you do that. Great report, Mike. My gosh.
Thank you.
Very, very comprehensive and exciting.
Too long.
Any questions?
My apologies.
No questions? All right. Thank you, Mike. So now it's up to Dr. Joe Mattern, our chief medical officer, to wrap things up almost. Just before the board wraps it up.
Sounds good. I guess if Mike felt like he had too many slides, I will average him out. See, well, you know, he had more than he wanted to have. I have zero. So somewhere that's probably the right average between the two of us. So I actually just want to make Mike made me think of something with comma and the kind of services that we talk about being important that we provide because of access to the community. I just want to make kind of one more push. If you really do believe we still need to move to a different way of, you know, paying for care in the U.S. and this idea of kind of, you know, paying for value and moving rurals in that direction, disincentives to coordination of care. So disincentives to services which help with the transition of care. So home health, SNFs, you know, mental health. If you don't have those, you know, some control or, you know, just the access to those in your community, you're never really going to move to that new phase. And I just think it's another reason why, you know, the idea of comma, if you're really trying to get a better care model. And just for the record, we are actually dabbling with the idea of an ACO again, Medicare ACO. We're looking at some options. So you'll probably be hearing more about that. And I think one of the reasons why we as an individual organization were, you know, I think we were successful for multiple reasons when we were in the Rocky Mountain ACO. And with different partners, I think moving forward, we can be successful in a new ACO model. But part of that is because we make those services work because we're trying to provide a coordination of care for our county residents. And that's part of our secret sauce. A lot of other things go into that as well, but I think it is an important piece of it. So, well, I figured I'd talk about COVID because you know, how could I not? So we'll start with that, but I will end on something sort of trying to move away from COVID. But just, I think most of you are probably aware that kind of what's happening across the Northwest region, which is we're at a point where the Northwest is in a fourth wave, while the rest of the country, the cases are actually, majority of the country, the cases have really diminished. And likely that we're going to see King County get moved back to phase two from phase three status. Looking at Jefferson County's and Clallam County's current numbers, I suspect that on Monday when they do the new analysis that we will stay in phase three, which obviously has significant implications for capacity at some of the local businesses, restaurants, for example. But I will expect that Kitsap County may very well end up move back to phase two. So I so we're, you know, just a reminder, we kind of talk about it every time, not out of the woods yet. And we are seeing the hospitalization rate go up across the state. It tends to be, we're seeing kind of what you would expect of who's not vaccinated, which is younger patients. If you were listening to NPR this morning, they were talking about the situation in Michigan, which is probably the worst in the country right now, starting to plateau and maybe come down a little bit. But reporting on pediatric hospitalizations and young children on ventilators with COVID. So this is just a reminder that this is we did not simply get the high risk population, you know, better covered with vaccination, and we're out of the woods here. So one of the things we have not seen the number of deaths go up in Washington state, which is good, but there is still a lot of morbidity with this virus. And some research in the last month, increasing body of research talking about the long-term effects after COVID, and study in Journal of American Medical Association last month, and showing that about 51% of people months after having COVID were describing things like fatigue, cognitive changes, difficulty breathing, still months later after their infection. And a study published in Nature this month talking about how 6 months later you can actually, they're seeing an increased mortality rates. This was among a VA population, so that people survived their COVID hospitalization, but 6 months later when they're looking, they're seeing increased rates of new use of diabetic medications, antidepressants, pain medications, new neurologic diagnoses. So they're seeing all these things, and the overall mortality rate, actually they're seeing about, for every 1,000 patients, they're seeing 8 additional excess deaths that are not directly from COVID, but maybe indirectly related to disease. And so when we're at this point with vaccine hesitancy, I think it's important for you all to continue with the messaging of, again, as people are relaxing, that still what a serious disease this is. So when people are kind of talking, or if you hear people saying, well, maybe I don't need to vaccinate, I think if I got it, I'd be okay. The answer is that the odds are not in your favor that, you know, you'll just be okay. And particularly if you're in that 30, 40, 50 age group, but even younger patients, we are seeing it. And with the variants, we are definitely seeing more infectivity and probably a bit more severity with the infections. I did want to let you know, since last time we did have one death in the hospital from a COVID patient. You might have seen that in the statistics. And I want to make you aware that that was a situation where a patient came in, they were actually many chronic medical issues. This was not someone who was in good health, and they had dealt with for a long period of time. And ultimately, the actual primary cause of death was a cardiac one. The patient ultimately ended up receiving palliative care based on their poor prognosis. COVID infection was discovered and might have been active or may have precipitated. It was probably the death. The hospital is considered COVID related, but on the death certificate, the primary cause of death is actually was a cardiac issue, but COVID does make it to the death certificate. So so that was unfortunate and sad and COVID related, but it was again an individual who was in pretty frail health. So we've been fortunate that of the COVID deaths we've had, we've not had people who were otherwise healthy. So those deaths already tragic as they are, but another reason why we need to get more of the population vaccinated, even though we are still leading the state. With that in mind, just to get a sense, I think by the end of the week, if you look at the state numbers, we're probably going to be around 60% of our county population will have initiated. That's full county population. Including children who are obviously aren't eligible for the vaccine, and probably about 50% of the population actually complete, so that will be considered fully vaccinated, which is pretty remarkable and really important since we don't have a lot of immunity likely within the community from previous infections. As Mike showed, 22,000 plus vaccines that we've administered ourselves. It's hard to do 200 of anything or 2,000 of anything. So if you think about 2,000 of anything, whether it's tests or vaccines, it's pretty remarkable. And just a reminder to all the staff that have made that possible. It's been incredibly resource intensive, but the energy and the dedication of the staff, I don't think we could say enough about. What's also remarkable, a statistic that we haven't focused on as much, but to give that many and to have 0.05% waste. So to really have treated these vaccines like the vital resource that they are, and to have the care to avoid that having any waste or minimizing it is really impressive. On the vaccine plan, probably the biggest thing this week is the Johnson & Johnson vaccine being back online, and we have reopened scheduling for that. So after the CDC had a pause on the vaccine to check the safety, and just so that you're aware, we were able to get updated. We got a clinical update. The medical officers did from the CDC call yesterday. And we have some new language on our education materials, and we're talking about a way to make sure that people who are scheduling are aware of the concern. I think the important thing to take home is if you're asking, someone's asking you which vaccine I should get, you should say, well, do you want the safe one, the other safe one, or the other safe one is actually the answer for it. And I'm kidding a little bit, but not really, because I think what's really important to understand is this is remarkable safety and remarkable efficacy for all three vaccines. The concern with the Johnson & Johnson is this thrombotic syndrome with thrombocytopenia or low platelets, which are clotting cells. It looks very similar. It's a reaction that looks very similar to another rare thing that happens with a medication that we've used in medicine for years called heparin. We can see a similar reaction. And very much actually how you diagnose this, confirm the diagnosis is actually using a similar test to when you suspect that diagnosis with heparin-induced thrombocytopenia. So what the CDC and the ACIP agreed on was they said, we're going to say absolutely the benefit outweighs the risk of this because the risk of COVID hospitalizations, mortality, and this reaction is very rare. What they were able to see when they paused and they looked at the data closely was that this reaction that happened in 13 women, there was one man who was actually authorization that they went back and looked and included, but primarily what these cases have happened in women, and primarily women in the ages 18 to 49. And so they had a couple considerations. They considered, the ACIP considered saying, well, maybe we should just not recommend it to people 18 to 49 or women not to 18 to 49. They cited still the risk in that population, which was there about 7 cases for per million, that with that such a low rate of this adverse effect, that it was still worth offering it to women, because if it was the only vaccine that was available, the benefit would be there. what we'd like to do, because this is a this is obviously still an extremely rare event that could happen. You're talking about one in 100,000 or more in that age group. We are going to do an effort to make sure that women have the choice. So from the standpoint of you could, you know, all the vaccines are safe, but if you want to pick the one that does not have the risk of this very rare event, and they the CDC did go back and do a data analysis, and this this adverse event is not associated with either the Moderna or the Pfizer. They were able to look through the data and show that this is specific to the Johnson & Johnson. It's also specific to the AstraZeneca too. So in AstraZeneca and Johnson & Johnson have a similar mechanism of how they deliver the vaccine, which is this adenovirus adenovirus vector. So there's something about that. There's something about that vector that triggers this reaction in a very small percentage of the population. So what we're going to do is we are not going to restrict anyone from having this vaccine as long as they're 18 and older. There will be additional education of what to look for. The reaction when it does occur is not immediate. It is somewhere between 15 days typically after the vaccination. So some awareness to what to look for, and also make it clear that they have the choice. So if someone is like, you know, I know it's rare, but I just can't get past this in my head, you know, making sure that they have they know they have an option for a Moderna, or they can get a Pfizer vaccine, and we can get them directed to the right spot, or we can get them scheduled with us. So we're working on that as a team, but it is another option, because the option of having a single vaccine, a single dose, you know, there are people who, while the survey data will show you there is less interest in Johnson & Johnson, there is still interest in it. And so it's great that we have it as an option. And I think hopefully we will be able to meet folks where they're at, that we have three vaccines to pick from. And so I think we're in a good situation to be able to hopefully get folks who are vaccine hesitant to feel like they've got something that works for them. So with regard to vaccine hesitancy, you know, we're hitting this point where we are seeing the demand for scheduling for the large events is starting to go down. And it's actually probably pretty good timing because we are making the plans to get out of the mass vaccination first dose business. We will be finishing up through June with people through second doses for large amounts. But what we're seeing is that folks, the number of folks who, you know, will sign up for, you know, 200, 300 vaccinations, and the interest is going down. The health department has seen that as well with the clinics at Chimicum. So we are beginning the planning of how to incorporate vaccination process back into our practices. So the clinics, specialty primary care, the ER. And that's actually probably good to coincide with trying to reach the vaccine hesitant people, because what we want to do is be able to have folks who are on the fence be meeting with a provider that they have a trusted relationship and hear the message delivered of, hey, I think you should have this. I think this is right for you. Do you want it today? Can we make it happen? And so the logistics of making that happen is a little bit trickier than you think, because of the ways that these vaccines work with as far as how they're stored and how long they last once you break the seal. But that's going to be our plan moving forward. And that makes more sense. We will be handing off. That doesn't mean that will be the end of all mass vaccination events. And in fact, we're going to be handing off to emergency management and public health. They will also be making use of some of our facilities, the drive up and the vaccines. We're making agreements with them to take over. But their work with that, as well as doing pop up clinics in specific places at churches or at where people work, or going down to the South County for people who are hard to reach, they will be doing that. The pharmacies will continue their work. And like I said, we will continue our campaign likely through the summer through the clinics. If there comes a time for booster vaccines, we may have to revisit the mask just because of the number. So as we get into the fall and winter, we could be back. But I think we're at a good point where making this transition and how we're doing the vaccines, I think is a good time. We also have, we're doing some other work. We have a work group to work on a plan to address vaccine hesitancy, including some strategies towards information that we can use for our providers to support their conversations with patients, as well as directing people externally. So lastly, on the COVID, I think you're probably aware the CDC also has released recently some new guidance around infection prevention, as well as new guidance for people who are fully vaccinated with regard to what they can do. And there is some direction specifically for healthcare facilities about how often surfaces need to be wiped down and clean. There's some different thinking about that from where we were in the beginning about how often certain surfaces need to be cleaned. There is still a desire for high touch surfaces and high traffic areas to probably be cleaned more regularly. So I think in our waiting rooms and registration areas, I don't think there's going to be a lot of change, but some other areas, some things can change. So the medical officers met with Laura Showers today, and we went through some potential wins in some areas. So we're going to be working through some adjustments in some of our protocols. Currently, I don't think you're going to see much change as far as visitation policy. Kind of what we're doing is probably going to stay. One of the things that may change is the salad bar may come back, which will hopefully be an employee satisfier maybe change a little bit about sort of how we manage the flow through dietary. So Laura is going to be reaching out to them. On masking too, we're reaching out to LNI. And so the CDC has suggested that you can consider not wearing masks if you have two vaccinated people within the same office or a meeting room. And that's a possibility in healthcare facilities. So, of course, LNI and the governor's office had certain mandates that they put down. So we have to see how those things coexist and how we would execute on that. So these are some of the things that we're kind of working on, a little bit of pulling back. But I think there's some real employee satisfiers potentially there. I think some messaging around ability to take your mask off outside, particularly which times well with the nice weather. So there will be some new messaging you can look for coming out of Laura's office. She's going to be doing some meetings with folks and anticipate that. And then lastly, what I was going to talk about was something that I, you know, would often bring up, which is what are we doing around provider wellness and sustainability? I don't know if how many of you saw the Washington Post article in the last couple weeks where they did a poll with the Kaiser Family Foundation, and that 3 out of 10 healthcare workers are thinking about getting out of healthcare because of after COVID, which is frightening. What's also frightening, I didn't realize till I went and dove into the article, is that the folks who are considering getting out, I think the younger healthcare workers actually were more likely to feel like they may have to get out, which is kind of if they're more burned out, that's pretty scary. If the pipeline is drying up, it's extremely worrisome. So even if we need to do a good job for our employees and for our clinicians. So you take a normally stressed work population, you add the effects of the pandemic on top of them, and if we end up with a decreased workforce, that means that a lot more competition for fewer folks. It means, more difficulty staffing, particularly in rural areas. So some of the work on the provider side that we've been doing or kind of re-engaging in, there's been some technology things that we've been doing. We've been piloting a single sign-on to reduce the number of times that your care team have to log in and out of the computers and Epic. So it's saving keystrokes and saving time. It may seem a little thing, but it's a huge satisfier. And so we've had a successful rollout of that technology in a couple of clinics. And so that will actually be expanding, and folks are looking forward to that. I know that I am. particularly since I seem to get one keystroke wrong about every fifth time and then have to type everything over again. So it adds up over the day. There's a new breakthrough in technology regarding documentation and virtual assistant. Think of the idea of Alexa or Siri for your Epic. And the ability to create clinical documentation using artificial intelligence as well as be a virtual assistant. So we've started to look at a couple of products and we're considering doing a pilot to try this technology. Could be a potential significant time saver for clinicians, particularly in the outpatient settings. So we're doing that. We're also, we've been optimizing some Epic performance. We've been doing targeted at the elbow support for providers based on utilization metrics. And we can see who's more likely using Epic at 2 o'clock in the morning, finishing their notes and what parts of the EHR they're working in. So Dr. Shatsky, who's been serving in a CMIO role, has been helping direct the informatics team to provide more targeted support for clinicians. And we think that we're underutilizing some of our existing technologies, so we're putting together a plan with regard to that. So some important work that had gotten obviously sidetracked with COVID that we want to get back on because we're going to need some solutions to help people work more efficiently, feel more productive. And then finally, last thing I'll say is we've got preliminary plans for a staff engagement education event in the fall. Obviously, we don't know kind of what numbers are going to look like. We had plans last fall for an event, but obviously that got canceled with COVID. So we're hoping with vaccinated staff and numbers down, we're hoping that maybe we can target an in-person event this year. So more to come on that, but we're beginning to put together a plan because it's going to be important to get people back together again and feel reconnected to one another. And I really think that as you know, healthcare workers potentially begin dropping out of the workforce and you are competing, particularly and you want the best and the brightest, you need to be an organization that cares about your employees, cares about your providers, and is also really dedicated to their mission and really connects the staff to the work and to the meaning of their work. And so that's going to be so important for us moving forward. And I know that was work that we were trying to do before COVID. And I think we can build on some of our successes, but just know that it is a fatigued workforce out there. So any questions?
Any questions from the board? Thank you, Dr. Madden.
Good report, Dr. Madden. Thank you.
Absolutely.
Welcome.
Thank you very much. All right, then we will go on to board business. And do you have a Board of Health report, Commissioner Call?
Thank you. I sent to the board the packet of information that the Board of Health received before the meeting that we had a bit more than a week ago. I apologize for not sending it out sooner, but it does have some very good information in it. First of all, it's a nice introduction concerning Dr. Melinda Bauer, who is the new provider for our two South County school clinics. It also, Joe talked a little bit about the disturbing reports regarding the sequelae from COVID-19, and you'll see an article that Dr. Locke provided us that also describes that. And then finally, it includes an excellent summary of the legislation that was passed forming four comprehensive public health districts in the state. Of interest is that obviously it still needs to be funded. And it only if a minimum amount of funding is provided, I think it's by July, will it actually go into effect. I think they're looking at a minimum requirement of $60 million from the general budget. And then the other thing is that by the year, I think it's 2023, it requires some significant changes in the composition of local boards of health. It requires an expansion of the local boards of health to include people from three different categories, including specific users of the services. And so once this legislation gets funded, there'll be further discussions at the Board of Health about what it means for us here. It does allow continued local control over local public health issues. It also continues to allow local boards of health to hire their own local public health officer, which is something that we felt was extremely important. And at the same time, these regional, these four statewide, or excuse me, four comprehensive regions for public health in the state will provide the kind of backup and support by each one of those regions will have their own public health officer as well, who will provide backup and who can then fill in for local public health officers if they get fired or if there's if they need more support in order to deal with boards of health that are not quite as friendly towards scientific evidence and requirements. So I think there's some very good things in the bill, and we were part of supporting it and making sure that local boards of health continue to have their own public health officer. And so I want to thank this board for your support. And I think we have a bill that's actually quite workable. So that's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions or comments? Thank you, Commissioner Call. Mari, I saw your hand up. Did you have something?
Yes, I just would like to bring up Jefferson Healthcare Foundation. You know, I'm a member of that board, and we are really excited to announce that we have two new members just to come on board, and they're experienced high quality members that we're delighted to have with us. Christine Walsh Rogers, who's the First Federal Vice President and Product Strategy Leader at the First Federal Bank, and you know, First Federal continues to be very supportive of our mission with grants and sponsorships. And Christine, although she lives at Cape George, she has been working in Seattle. She's also experienced on other nonprofit boards and is currently, or has been recently, currently a chair of president of one in Seattle. And our other great addition is Dr. Kate Marshall, and she's the director of research at Madigan Army Medical Center. And she also volunteers and helps lead other Jefferson County nonprofits. And she lives in Hadlock, so she has a long commute. But she's got a PhD in molecular biology and a BA in biology and Russian studies. So she's really a fantastic and a young person who lives in Port Hadlock. So that's great. And then, of course, they join the two new members we had last year. And I don't think I formally introduced them. And that is Stephanie Gale from Gale Investment Management, who has been a long time in our community, over 20 years. I met her 25 years probably ago. And Rebecca Kimball, who is one of our retired nurse practitioners from the department, our oncology department. So our board is really, that's Jefferson Healthcare Foundation board, is really eager and excited to play a role in supporting the master site plan and hopefully do something very productive and supportive for the phase 1 and 2A expansion with diagnostic imaging. So we are excited on the foundation board to do our part, play our role, and get things going.
Great. That sounds good. Well, thank you for all your work on that, Mari. That's really important work.
Thank you.
Foundation. Anybody else? Matt or Bruce?
I do have one question for Mari.
Yes.
When is the next event, Mari? I know you're very good at promoting that, and I just want to get ready for it.
Well, if I had an event to tell you about, KSI would have promoted it. You know me. But I'll be sure to let you know, because events, you know, in public, in person, are somewhat challenging and at the moment. But hopefully with things opening up, something will happen. And one thing about our new board members, they have come from, or at least a lot of experience in 501c3s in their other lives, and they're coming with good ideas. So I'll be sure to let you know. Thanks for asking.
And then, Jill, I did have one other question for the board.
Uh-huh. Yes.
Which is, I read today a note from Melissa that Hospital Week is coming up in May, and she was asking if the board had any ideas for how we can support that. And I wonder if we could take 3 minutes to brainstorm what we might do collectively to celebrate our staff and to respond to Hospital Week.
Well, do you have any ideas?
Well, I do know that at one point Bruce had the brilliant idea and sponsored coffee for staff at the local espresso stand that's in the, not in the QF, well, I guess that's the QFC parking area.
That came out of Bruce's pocket, Case.
I know it did. And that was great. And I'd certainly be willing to join the board if we came up with a collective idea of offering something.
And I did a couple of goes of early on in the pandemic of free cookies at lunchtime that I personally donated. Not the cookies, but the finances.
I think typically the our teams come up with ideas, and then they include us and ask us where we would like to fit in. So they have an overall picture of what's going to be happening and what's going to be safe and what's not. So why don't we ask them to let us know what we can do to help. And if in the meantime you think of anything, we can approach them, talk to Alyssa, and she can get it to the right person. How about that?
The schedule, the thing that Alyssa sent out said that Monday is bagels, Tuesday need to figure out, Wednesday figure out, Thursday is cupcakes, and Friday is ice cream.
Yes.
What if we were to ask Aaron Stark if there's something that the commissioners could help fund for Tuesday and Wednesday, or if we want to, help support something.
Yes, baked potatoes.
Sure, we could do that. Alyssa, maybe you could talk to Aaron and see if there's something that we can do along that line and get back to us. That would be great.
Yes,
thanks, Case. Great idea. Thanks for Kate thinking of that. If there's nothing further, we are running a little bit late. But
Jill, if I may interrupt. So I assume no barbecue.
I don't know. I did not see it on the in the task list.
Yeah, no, we're not doing that. Yes. I know.
Darn.
I know.
That's fun. So we'll look forward to next year doing the barbecue. That's for sure.
Yep, absolutely.
Okay, so we're moving on to the meeting evaluation, and that brings up something that I'd like to ask if the board would be interested. Jamie Orlikoff had a segment of a presentation where he had a question about board self-evaluation and the best, how you can get the maximum out of that process. And it's about a 5-minute segment video, and I would like to bring it to the board and use it for a at the beginning of next month's meeting in the governance section and stimulate a little conversation. And he's got some good ideas about how we can develop a plan or and ask the right questions to develop a plan to make the board evaluation really more robust, because I think we just right now we just say yes, great reports and things, but he believes in setting an actual plan and how to develop the board and then some benchmarks along the way. So I think that would be something that would be really good for us to discuss next time. If you think that's a good topic, say yes, and I'll make the arrangements.
Sounds good.
Yep. Sounds good.
Sounds good.
Sounds good to me too.
All right. We'll do it. Thank you. Okay. So meeting evaluation. Bruce.
Yeah. As always, it was a good meeting. We covered a lot of things. One thing that stood out to me, I think, is that the last slide that was in Mike's thing about how the county is done, as far as vaccinations and everything through COVID, be nice if that showed up in the newspaper, maybe with a little blurb about, yeah, part of that is, you know, the hospital and I mean, what we've done as far as vaccinations, but a lot of it was people using the personal steps to stay healthy. And, you know, they can't give up on wearing masks and social distancing until, you know, we have everybody vaccinated.
Good point. All right. Matt?
Yeah, it was tons of great information. I agree. I was very struck by that slide, and our county should feel just incredibly proud of the work that everyone's done. And also, I was just really excited to see that we're doing a design build for this the new building. I'm really excited and interested in see how that process goes.
Maury?
Yes, I endorse everything that's been said so far. And just a note to all the heroes, the vaccinators in Jefferson County, and particularly our own employees and staff. The chambers had that sign up down at their board, their reader board. And it's a testament to the teamwork and the enthusiasm and the selflessness of our staff, our medical staff, our employees, and all the volunteers. And I can't speak highly enough of them. So I think the meeting was great, great information. I'm excited about the master site plan and roles that I can play in those plans. I think it was an excellent meeting.
Case?
I agree with everything everyone else has said. I heard that Mike was a little apologetic about all of his slides, but I honestly don't see how the board can do its work if we don't get enough information and have an opportunity to really see it and ask questions. So I think the idea of 5 slides per presentation might work for very routine types of things. But the reality is that we're dealing with many non-routine things here. And so I don't think I would change a thing in the presentations that we're getting at this point. I think it's excellent. And I think it's truly remarkable that we're thinking long-term while we're still struggling short-term with both the pandemic and with finances. So it's a testament to big thinking and short-term crisis management.
Well, and the other thing is that Mike was, he didn't go over on time, so he doesn't need to apologize for how many slides he has. He was still on time.
That's true to the minute. Well, I can't add anything really other than, except for the concern about the burnout of younger people coming into the medical field. That's the only unsettling thing I really saw. Otherwise, what a wonderful, uplifting, it feels like a weight's been lifted and spring is coming and the world is getting better. Spend most of that here is thank you to our teams, our people in Jefferson Healthcare. So thank you, everyone. So is there a motion to adjourn?
So move.
Conclude.
So move.
Is there a second?
I did, yes.
All right. Discussion? Okay. Over and out.
Thank you, everybody.